Thank you, Madam Clerk, and welcome everybody to the December 16th meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. If you would like a little assistance hearing proceedings in chambers today, we do have hearing assist devices stored at the end of the dais. And with that, if you would, all please rise and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Madam Clerk, changes to today's agenda, please.
Added item to closed session, 1, personnel. It is the intention of the board to meet in closed session to 17, consider public employee appointment for the position of Director of Parks and Recreation. Requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour notice and requirement.
Very good. And, Council, are we adjourning to that closed session for tomorrow?
Yes. So at the end of the day today, we will adjourn to tomorrow morning for that closed session item.
Very good. And we'll take public comment on that closed session item tomorrow morning. With that, we come to our consent agenda. I have one request to speak in front of me, Mr. Britton, from Public Works. And those of you with interest in speaking on public comment items not on the agenda, if we could have your slips to the dais, please. Mr. Britton.
Chairman Gibson, Honorable Board, I'm Michael Britton with Public Works Department. It came to our attention yesterday, associated with item number one, that the map we provided was incorrect. So I went back and we checked the legal description. The legal description is correct, but I have an updated map for your...
For the clerk, and very good. And you have copies for the board?
Yes.
Very good. Thank you, sir.
And so if there are any questions?
Don't think so. We're good. Thank you, Mr. Britton. And another request to speak on consent, Chief Lewin.
Good morning, Chair and Board. I just wanted to take a moment on consent today on item 10. You'll be reviewing a contract with Mid-America Solar out on the Topaz Solar Farm out in Carrizo. That will be a continuation of paramedic services in the Carrizo at the fire station out there. This is an excellent opportunity to demonstrate once again public-private partnership with the solar companies out in the Carrizo. The paramedics that will be out there will provide service not just to the solar farms, but also to the citizens out in that community who need it. We appreciate your support on this, and we particularly appreciate the relationship with Mid-America that the county has. So thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Chief. I have no other requests to speak, and so we'll close it to public comment, bring it back to the board colleagues for items to pull. Ms. Ray. Mr. Meacham.
None.
Mr. Hill.
None, sir.
Ms.
Quickly, number 10.
No, number 10. And I don't have any, so to number 10.
Okay, and I, too, want to just echo Chief Lewin's remarks. Mid-American has just been a wonderful neighbor and done just a lot, very very generous to the community, and District 5 and the entire county, I think, appreciates your presence. So thank you.
Very good. With that, I'd entertain a motion on consent as amended.
So moved.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham, and thank you, Ms. Ray. With that, a roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Thank you. We are then at public comment for items not on the agenda within the purview of the board. And Mr. Margetson will take your slip. I'm sure you'd like to report on needs and wishes. We'll start with Julie Tacker, followed by Cindy Steinbeck.
Agriculture, private well owners, rural residential. And I'm not clear, and this is where I have questions and hope to see an update in the future, is this the same as the 218 for the undeveloped lots that were supposed to be caught in an environmental assessment post-wastewater project that would include costs for a habitat conservation plan, costs for the LCP amendment that updates our community plan, or our Estero area plan. And that was supposed to have been had in like 2008, 2009, and we still haven't done that. But this is also supposed to encompass the cost of a future water supply. So I'm not clear, and I hope you bring back an item in the new year that folds all this together so that we have a full comprehension of what indeed is proposed, and then how are we going to get there? How are we going to get there? Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Tacker. Ms. Steinbeck, followed by Lindy Owen.
Good morning. Cindy Steinbeck, Paso Robles. We all know that taxpayer funds cannot be misused, nor should they. All spending should be transparent. And in these following examples, neither of that has taken place. Taxpayer funds misused is a Carollo contract for $750,000 for a supply-side option when there is no state water available. We've mentioned that numerous times. A contract with John Hollenbeck. Taxpayer funds being spent to take a water district to LAFCO. Taxpayer funds misused by Public Works and Courtney Howard in the proposal to spend $75,000 to request education and public awareness for the water district. The advisory board is not a political board. It's an advisory board, and they are directing the use of taxpayer funds and a direct request from Public Works. And this is not conspiracy theory. This is conspiracy against rural landowners. May 2013, the Paso Robles Wine Country Alliance voted to support the creation of a water district. June 2013, Prague states to the PRWCA board that they aim to secure financial and technical resources to hire expert teams that will help develop and implement an action plan with the main goal of avoiding adjudication. Courtney Howard, October 2013, we need a robust AB 3030 so as not to trigger adjudication. This is a conspiracy against overlying landowners. The proposed water district, as with water districts in other areas, are proven to generate tremendous amount of income. We need to investigate the players in Prags and Pro Water Equity as to their financial interests in this. Public funds are being requested and may be used for marketing a water district that will eventually harm landowners. It's been proven in many other areas. Transparency in public spending is a necessity by law. And if we do not take the money that's being requested, that $75,000, and bring it before the Board of Supervisors, I have no opportunity to do a due process to be able to comment on that. The water district propaganda is being used in the name of education. It's to lull landowners into thinking that this is something that is good for them when, in fact, the very opposite is true. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Steinbeck. Ms. Owen, followed by Ben DeFottam.
Okay. Good morning, Lindy Owen from Los Osos. I wanted to begin with, the erosion problems in Los Osos, as I've been, you know, we've been concerned that the unfinished shoulders and parking areas that were disrupted by the construction were never buttoned up, and now we have the sand erosion. At a traffic and circulation meeting, we had to discuss having extra sweepers from the county to come in and sweep, as well as skip loaders, because it is in the roads as expected. And my point was, until it's fixed to get my rebate, I spent over $1,000 for a couple of toilets that I put in prior to the time that they're accepting, but I was told that I would get credit, and I also purchased a front-loading washing machine. It appears that I've been denied, but there's no reason. This is from Mr. Danzo. there's nothing marked in there in my denial. So I just want to say this process, if we have $2 million left at least in the fund for the conservation, can the county please put somebody to expedite these things professionally? I'm a little frustrated because now I have to take my time to go into the office and find out what happened. And I was promised in person that I would have credited those two toilets that I put in. And now it looks like, I mean, I have no idea. So just want to wish you a Merry Christmas, too. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. Mr. DeFatta, followed by Gary Kirkland.
Good morning. I am Ben DeFatta from Los Osos. Well, now that we've survived another whole year, we've learned a little more about each other. My parting words for this year is that in last week's Bay News article, it says that the community of Los Osos is in jeopardy of losing its only water supply. Rob Miller of the CSD's engineer says that the main issue here is seawater intrusion, where the CSD's only drinking water supplies for this community have diminished to roughly half. General Manager Kel Kively said to Bay News, if we don't conserve, we won't have any water to pump. She further stated that the community has been in overdraft for many years, and a long-time goal for the consumer would be to cut water uses another 20%. Well, what do you know about that? The public this summer saw millions of gallons of high groundwater in the trenches being pumped by the contractors into the bay. And despite many comments and complaints to our supervisor, this board and county engineers, as usual, nothing was done about it. Furthermore, more saltwater intrusion came about because of the waste of time and money trying to build a plant at the Tunini site way out past Los Osos a few miles over a year. It took another year and another $1 million. On top of that, not completing the treatment plant at the same time as the sewer pipes were completed, we now have to wait another 2 years for that to be completed. And then on top of that, it will take another 2 years for the 5,000 hookups to the street pipes are completed, making it a total of at least 4 more years of saltwater intrusion into our only drinking water. Our general manager goes on to say that the CSD approved new water rates that are designed to build up a reserve in order to spend another $24 million on a list of projects to slow down further saltwater intrusion. Shouldn't this all have been done at the same time as I mentioned above? That's a big hit for this community. I guess I'm running out of time. So now we go to the next chapter down in Arroyo Grande. Where did all the millions of dollars that were held in reserves go to that Mr. Wallace and his conflict of interest Wallace Engineering Group used up? Where are all the files for the last 10 years? Follow the money. Who knows what lurks in the minds of men the district attorney knows? Merry Christmas to you all.
You, Mr. DeFatta, thank you.
Happy New Year. See you next year.
All right. Mr. Kirkland, followed by Eric Greening.
Thank you very much. I'm Gary Kirkland. A couple of issues. One, last week the board spent quite a bit of time discussing the Margarita Ranch and whether they were going to be allowed to develop or whatever. And I tried to follow, did you allow development? Did you not? I'm not sure. But anyway, my point was being, I'm here to defend private property rights. And for those people who wished to have something else on the Margarita Ranch other than what they did get, my suggestion to them was that you buy it. And if you can't afford it, you live without it. And if you bought it, you should be allowed to do whatever you wish with it. Now, one of the supervisors mentioned the Hearst Ranch. Well, the reason the Hearst Ranch is developed like it was because Randolph Hearst had the money to do it, and therefore he did, and then he donated it to the state. Anybody who has the money could buy the Margarita Ranch and develop it in a way they should. Instead, we have people who try to use the tyranny of government to try to force development that they wish without paying for it. They want the people who own the ranch to develop something that they don't want, that people who don't own the ranch want. And so, therefore, defending private property rights, this board should not interfere with private people building on their own land. What they can do is, using your own money, buy the place and do with it as you wish. On another issue that Cindy Steinbeck brought up, I understand that you're going to do a public relations campaign to convince people to support the water district. Well, there are those of us who are opposed to the water district, and it's my tax money. I would think you should do equal amount of money.
There seems to be a missing piece, and I'm going to be inquiring about it. Right now, there is a draft environmental impact report on a renewable energy zone that will cover much of the county, quite a significant part of this county's area. It is more or less a pre-CEQA for future projects that will then not have their own individual CEQA, unless there's presumably listed species there, then they might get a little bit of CEQA. But the process by which that is determined, the sort of biological once over before deciding that, is kind of unclear to me, as is the public process. In any event, anyone interested in this can make comments on the draft EIR and can access that draft EIR through the county building planning and building website, and comments are due by the end of the year, so we have a couple of weeks to do it. I want to raise the agricultural issues involved, because there would not be any further CEQA relative to the agricultural values, and it appears ours would be the only county in the state allowing major industrial energy projects on Williamson Act land. Currently, this does not count, it's not found compatible under our county's rules of procedure. Table 2 of our rules of procedure list electrical generating plants as non-compatible uses. The Renewable Energy Streamlining Plan proposes to add to that table a new category of renewable energy facilities that would, under certain circumstances, be compatible. Now, this amendment, our Ag Preserve Review Committee has been told that this amendment to the rules of procedure would require its own CEQA process. And my question right now before the board is, where is that CEQA process? Because it's hard to make sense of the CEQA process on the Renewable Energy Streamlining Plan as a whole without a companion CEQA process on the impacts on the Williamson Act land of this change of rules of procedure. If it's trailing along afterwards, then it's hard to make intelligent comments on the CEQA that's in front of us. And I have not, in my own search through the county sites, been able to find any CEQA document on this change in the rules of procedure. So that's my inquiry right now. And do have a Merry Christmas and a happy holiday season.
Thank you, and you too, Mr.
Happy Beethoven's birthday today.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Margetson.
Richard Margetson. Needs and wishes, we don't have a total yet. I'm actually delivering a piece of pottery in the building after I'm done making my public comment. And then meeting a lady in front of Kohl's to drop off $450 items that she was high bidder on the silent auction. We'll have a total towards the end of the week. The event was successful. One of the successful things this year, though, was all of the recipients, a member of the board of every recipient was in Los Osos that day, went on stage and spoke to the audience that was watching at home. The event was televised live in Los Osos. Representing Maxine Lewis Memorial Shelter was Biz Steinberg, Executive Director of CAPSLO, and John Spadafore. They talked about the new shelter, the capital campaign, where it was going. Kevin Michelonis, President of the Board for Transitional Food and Shelter, also came and told about the increasing cost of housing the homeless when they come out of a hospital today in a hotel room, with some pretty startling figures and costs that I think the audience found very interesting. And then third, Rupert Chowans, my personal hero, spoke about the ongoing, continuing increase in the participation of the doctors in this county in making the NOR Clinic just an exceptional model for volunteerism. Unbelievable what they've done in the 3 or so years that they've been in existence. They were wonderful presenters. It was a wonderful opportunity. That was, besides the money we raised, I think that was just as important this year. I also wanted to make a comment. There's charity events in this county all year long. Most of them don't happen without the contributions of the business community. I personally would like to thank all of them out there, not just for our event. We get hundreds of donations, but for all of the events. I'm sure it gets tiring during the course of...
Johnson mentioned the Maxine Lewis Shelter, and I hope everyone had a chance to read the article in the paper over the weekend on a little bit of the life of Maxine Lewis herself. I did not know her, and I did not know anything about her, and I thought that she sounded like a remarkable woman. With that, then, Madam Clerk, when you're ready, our first item, please.
Item number 17, submittal of a resolution amending the position allocation list for Fund Center 186, Veterans Services, to add 2.0 full-time employee limited term assistant Veterans Services officer position in support of the Supportive Services for Veterans Families program, approval of a corresponding budget adjustment in the amount of $101,374, and signing a contract between the county and the Community Action Partnership of San Luis Obispo to provide staffing for the program, all districts.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. Mr. Cummings, morning.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board, staff. I have a presentation here to show you guys, kind of give you a general overview of the program. We are requesting two positions to help out in seeking out the veterans in the community and plugging them into their benefits and services that they've earned. So the program is called the Supportive Service for Veterans and Families, the SSVF program. It's a program done by the VA, and it's a nationwide program. And we're doing it as part of the San Luis Obispo Continuum of Care, which is overseen by the HSOC. The mission of the program is to assist very low-income eligible veterans and families residing in or transitioning to permanent housing with wraparound services from several agencies that are designed to promote housing stability. So the idea is you take a veteran who's possibly homeless or actually becoming homeless, and you provide everything they need to get back on their feet. So it could be mental health counseling. It might be taking them down to social services to get them on food stamps, plugging them into VA services such as medical benefits. If they've got a service-connected disability, getting them a claim through so they can get some compensation for that disability. Or if they're a wartime veteran, plugging them into their VA pension, which would help them out financially and on the road to stability. Based on a report by HUD, the Tribune reported in January of 2014 that San Luis Obispo County had the third largest homeless population that was unsheltered in the nation. We have gotten better in the last year. We're now at fourth in that report. So things are improving, but there's definitely a long way to go. During the last point in time count, we had 237 chronically homeless veterans that were on the streets of San Luis Obispo County. So that's a large number. And Veterans Services estimates that we have roughly 1,100 at-risk veterans living within the county. Now, what is an at-risk veteran? These are veterans that are on unemployment. These are veterans that are under age 65, that are wartime veterans that are receiving a pension for some kind of disability that they've incurred outside of service, but they're unable to take care of themselves, and so they're receiving a pension from the VA. These are veterans that are students going to school, living solely off their GI Bill, which is a short-term program that gives them roughly about $1,500 a month to live off of. And we see some of these that are, because of their family situation, they're below the poverty level, and so we consider them at risk. And these are also veterans, if it weren't for whether it's a GI Bill or pension, keeping them in a house, if they were to get hurt or something else were to happen, they would lose their housing and be on the street. Next slide, please. So who's involved in the program here in our county? The two main players here are the Community Action Partnership of San Luis Obispo, CAPSLO, and the Five Cities Homeless Coalition in partnership with Good Sam's Shelter out of Santa Maria. They both were approved to apply for the grant this last spring through the HSOC. They applied and received grant funding. CAPSLO received $4.9 million in grant funds, and the Five Cities Homeless Coalition received roughly 1.1 in grant funds for a total of 6 million over the next 3 years. Part of CAPSLO's grant application was to combine forces with Veteran Services and have these two positions to help them reach out to the veteran community, and basically have the experts in the county plugging these veterans in with their benefits and services. The role of our staff will be much like the role of the staff that we have now, but they'll be doing much more intensive case management. So they'll conduct outreach to the homeless veterans and the at-risk veterans throughout our county. They'll assist in identifying the veterans that have the ability to apply for these benefits and services, and they'll assist them in those application process, whether it be from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, CalVet, or other local agencies that do have veterans programs. And part of this intensive case management for these veterans is that this will help them to ensure that they get all the necessary requirements. There's about 1,300 plus that we have in the county that could potentially benefit from this program. Well, this program won't serve all of them. Out of those 1,300, we're going to have some that don't qualify for these different benefits and programs. So we'll, direct them to other services. Like we have the 51st program that's going right now. Some of those are veterans in that program. They may or may not qualify for this program, depending on their discharge status and stuff like that. So, and we also have the VASH program, which is another housing program for veterans. So we will, where needed, direct veterans to the more appropriate program. And so the goal right now is to get the most, to get roughly 250 of the ones that will benefit the most from this program through the program in the next 3 years. With a ramp-up cycle here, as you can see under the targets, as we ramp up, do the hiring, get everything in place this first year, we're hoping to help about 28 veterans. And then the second year, we're hoping to help another 80. And by year three, as everything's, cranking out, we should be help about 140 that year, with a total of roughly 248 veterans getting support for the program. Now the results. Go next slide. The results of the program. How are we going to judge success? Well, our success will be with our target population to be self-sustaining with stable housing, be receiving medical benefits, which would include physical care and mental health benefits, have a source of income, whether that be employment, VA compensation for service-connected disability, or VA pension or Social Security, and then education. Maybe it's education that's holding them back. They've been laid off or whatever. Get them retrained, get them plugged into a system to get some schooling. The VA has many programs for education, whether it be the GI Bill, the VDAP. There's a whole bunch of different programs that they have. And so we'll judge our success by how these guys come out of this, and hopefully we'll have 248-plus veterans. I'm hoping we'll overshoot that number by quite a bit. And that's basically what we're looking for, and we're hoping that we'll get the board to approve the PAL amendment and the contract to work with CAPSLO on this. Is there any questions?
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Cummings. I think we do. Mr. Meacham.
Thank you. Dan, do you come across any at all of the veterans that decline the service?
We do. We have vets that they're happy where they're at. They've, for whatever reason. And so we just kind of keep at them. I'm thinking of one in particular over at Prado we see on Thursdays. He's just...
I know when you would engage a veteran and speak to them about the benefits that are afforded to them, do some of them just decline those benefits altogether?
They do. Some do. Unfortunately, Vietnam-era veterans, they did not get the most rosy welcome home when they came home. And so we have some of those folks still that are living on the street that they don't want anything to do with the government, and they look at us as the problem, not the solution, and they're fine where they're at. And it's just, it's just sad to see, but it's a reality.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Arnold?
Quick question. Dana, thank you for your presentation. Do you see a role of the stand-down event will be coming up? An opportunity to, because some of those vets that take advantage of the stand-down event don't necessarily take advantage of the programs, but now that you have so many opportunities, it might be.
I definitely see the stand-down as an opportunity. We've used the stand-down in the past to plug veterans in with other programs, whether it be VASH or employment services and stuff like that. So, yeah, we definitely intend to target this year's stand-down towards veterans where we can help with this program as well, and we'll have staff there to do that. That's one of the great things about this. If we can get these two positions, you know, that's a program that those two folks can really concentrate on because that's their target audience, is the folks that are coming to the stand down.
And then these programs should be fully functioning by the time the stand down event rolls around.
I predict they will be.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much, sir. I don't see any other questions. I have no request to speak, and seeing no one coming forward, I'll close it to public comment. Bring it back to the board. Mr. Meacham.
I would move staff's recommendation.
Thank you.
Second.
Thank you, Ms. Arnold. Under discussion, I'll only say I am encouraged about what we see. I think we have partnerships in place that are going to make a difference in people's lives. I appreciate the good work that your office does to reach these special people who have special sets of needs that you are quite adept at meeting. So we'll wish you well and look forward. Mr. Hill.
And just one more quick note. I think it's a great program, but I've been advised to abstain on this one, so I'm going to do so. But
all right. Thanks, sir. So within that, then, Madam Clerk, please a roll call.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Abstain, please.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Board. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Doc. Appreciate it. Madam Clerk, then our next item, please.
Item number 18, a hearing to consider approval of ordinances to amend County Code Title II, Chapter 2.36, Purchasing Agent, and adding Chapter 2.37, Informal Bidding.
Uniform informal bidding and accounting standards, as well as provided certain dollar thresholds when using informal bidding procedures for public construction projects. Some subsequent time after that in 2011, the AB 720 was signed into law, which provided an increase in those monetary limits to $175,000. Up in front of you, what you have today is the current informal bidding process. It's rather complicated as well as it's outdated. It doesn't align to the monetary limits established in 2011. There is also a few things that provide sort of inefficiencies for staff as we navigate this, which is bringing every informal bidding project under $175,000 today in front of your board to both authorize and award that contract. What you have in front of you now is the proposed ordinance process that we'd like to use. Really, what this allows us to do is save about 45 to 60 days per project, as well as it provides efficiencies in the staff time taken to bring an item to your board. Specifically, what it does is allow the purchasing agent the authority up to $175,000 for public construction projects. To allow that to happen, we'd really need to do a few things. One of them would be amend 2.36, which is the purchasing agent ordinance, add 2.37, which would clearly outline informal bidding procedures for the county to use and the purchasing agent to use, as well as amend the contracting for services policy section 4.2, which prescribes how we handle public construction contracts here within the county. Which really brings me to the recommendations. So the recommendations would be to waive the reading of the ordinance, approve the purchasing agent, the ability to provide the informal bidding ordinances and execute those, as well as update the contracting for services policy section 4.2. And finally, I'd like to say that item and ordinance 2.36 was provided unsigned in error. A copy of the signed ordinance has been provided to the clerk.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Van Dorn. So signed ordinance being County Council's approval of County Council said it was okay. I did have one question. In reading through the staff report, the title purchasing agent is used. And I just, to be clear in my own mind, had a question as to whether is that a specifically designated individual or job position, or is it a specific person acting on behalf of a project and might vary from time to time?
Sure. So that authority is by ordinance, and that's given to the General Services Director. Okay. They have the authority as the purchasing agent, and then they delegate that essentially to the person that oversees purchasing for the county, which would be the department administrator currently in the General Services Department.
Okay, very good. Mr. Meacham?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think I asked Dave this question yesterday in terms of the checks and balances between the departments? We have the purchasing agent that signs off on things. How are we coordinating, I guess, these? I just want to make sure that we have everything covered in terms of the checks and balances of the total dollar amount once we've elevated this up.
Dave Flynn with Public Works. Yeah, to respond to your question, essentially our informal bidding process that would be done by Public Works or any other department would be done through the purchasing agent. And so we would be working through a centralized system of who the contractors that these packages would be sent out to be bid, and then the final award would be done through the purchasing agent. So while departments will come forward with different requests, it's really the purchasing agent's responsibility to assure that we're following the informal bidding process.
But then you would, when the purchasing agent will be signing a contract, the department that has, let's say, for example, Public Works, they would review that contract to make sure that everything would be covered in that contract. Is that? I'm trying to figure out how that process works.
Yeah, to expand on that more then, would be we would develop a contract with, say, plan specification and estimates and review it totally internal to ourselves. Okay. Then we would then send it to the purchasing agent to follow the informal bidding process. We would then receive bids in which purchasing would let us know what the results are. And then based off of that information and our financial commitment to the project, we would then recommend to the purchasing agent to award the bid.
And any amendments in between, that would be handled by the department that submitted that?
Correct. If there is some addendum or any other type of correction to be made.
Thank you.
Very good. Supervisor Ray, and we have council and CAO waiting to weigh in as well.
Do you want to go first? Okay. Just real quickly, so in the case of an amendment that would take it over the $175,000 threshold, would that then come here to BOF?
So there is a little bit of clarification. So if we received a bid back that was greater than $175,000, there is a $12,500 sort of flexibility that would then have to come to the board, and the board would have the authority to award that additional $12,500 up and beyond. So it's essentially $187,500, which would be the maximum award that whether it was essentially the board that went through the informal bidding process could award a contract up to that amount.
Right. Okay. And then the purpose of this is essentially, you know, to put it plainly, to get the board out of the loop. And I say that in a good way, in that what you're saying is when you say we're going to save 45 or 60 days, then what we're doing is we're not adding the staff time and the public review time on these smaller projects that increase cost to taxpayers. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. We would see utilizing this for smaller projects like refurbishing traffic signals, our annual ADA curb ramp program. So very straightforward. And we would likely see a savings in the neighborhood of about $5,000 per project just because of the reduced staff reports and preparations.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Ms. Neal, Mr. Buckshire?
Yes, Rita Neal, County Council. Just to follow up on a couple of these questions, Supervisor Meacham, first of all, our office will continue to be involved with the contracts, the approval of the plans and specifications. So we continue to be part of that process. Additionally, if the bids come in, for example, over the $175,000 threshold, or we think that the project is going to exceed that amount, there's, first of all, there's change order limits that can't exceed, I believe it's the $12,500. So those projects are never going to go over a particular amount, and if they do and the bid comes higher, we step back and we bring that to the board. So that's the checks and balance from the financial aspect. During the process, purchasing is certainly approving that, but Public Works and or General Services continue to be the project managers and are monitoring the project and the cost throughout.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Very good.
All right. With no further questions, I'll open it to the public. I have no request to speak, and seeing no one coming forward, I'll bring it back to the board. Entertain a motion.
I'll move staff recommendations.
Thank you, Ms. Arnold, and thank you, Mr. Meacham, and that includes waiving the reading and the amendment of the signature by County Council. With that, then, please, a roll call vote.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. And then, Madam Clerk, you can introduce the next item, which will have a certain familiar ring to it.
Item number 19, a hearing to consider a proposed ordinance of the San Luis Obispo County Flood Control and Water Conservation District to provide informal bidding procedures under the California Uniform Public Construction Cost Accounting Act, all districts.
Good. So we are at this point sitting as the board of the Flood Control District. Mr. Flynn?
All right. Yes, good morning, Board. Dave Flynn with Public Works. Yes, as your role as the County Flood Control and Water Conservation District, this informal bidding ordinance would have to be adopted as you sit in that position. So this is a separate entity. The process will mirror exactly the county ordinance that you've adopted previously. And one item that to note in this process, and this is true of the previous action that you took, is adoption of the ordinance also delegates the authority to the Director of Public Works or their designee for the approval of those plans and specifications that we had talked about in the previous item. That, too, affords agency protection as we move forward with implementing the projects. This action does require adoption by your board to enact the ordinance, and with that, we would recommend waiving the reading of the ordinance, approve the informal bidding process for the Flood Control District, and then designate the county clerk to publish the ordinance. And that concludes my report. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Flynn. Seeing no questions from the board, I will open it to the public. Have no request to speak on this item, and no one coming forward, I'll bring it back to the board and entertain a motion.
Move staff recommendation.
Thank you, Ms. Meacham. Thank you, Ms. Arnold, with the waiving of the reading and the similar amendment of the ordinance as signed by County Council.
Correct.
And with that, then, Madam Clerk, a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Our next item was going to be led by Ms. Douglas Schatz. Shall we give her five? Is she scurrying down the stairs?
She is on her way. Apparently, we're moving ahead of schedule this morning. So,
Well, we will we'll call. How about a 10 minute?
Yeah.
10 minutes. We'll start right at 10 o'clock. Then, Madam Clerk, we are back, and if you would please introduce our next item.
Item number 20, a hearing to consider a proposed ordinance amending Section 2.48.095 of the County Ordinance Code regarding compensation increases for the Board of Supervisors, all districts.
Thank you. Ms. Douglas Schatz.
Thank you, Chairman Gibson, members of the Board. I am here to recommend changes to County Ordinance 2.48095, Board of Supervisors compensation. There are two goals in the recommendation today. The first is to update the methodology that we use to establish the market pay rate for Board of Supervisors. We want to get it in alignment with what we have bargained or in the process of bargaining with our other bargaining units, and we also want to change the annual salary. This is the current ordinance language, and I've highlighted in orange there some of the key areas that the recommendation is to change, and the first paragraph A shows the current salary at $82,014.40, and in paragraph B, it identifies the current language about who we survey when we are looking for market rate for the board, and those current counties, there's only five, and we have changed this with all the other bargaining units, and they're listed as Marin, Monterey, Napa, Santa Barbara, and Santa Cruz. That paragraph goes on to provide a formula to bring any out-of-market wages into market by finding the average and bringing it up to parity. The proposed change is in paragraph A, to bring the annual salary to $86,115.12, and in paragraph B, to change the market survey approach to the current market approach. And you can see highlighted that we're looking to collect data in the same manner that, or similar manner, that we're determining prevailing wage for recognized employee organizations. The formula is removed in this language, and we're able to consider the county's current financial condition or anything else that's important at the time when we're looking at wages. So based on that proposed ordinance change, we did a salary survey, and we used the current method that we're using with other employee organizations, looking at local employers, surrounding counties, demographically similar counties. And the elements that we survey are the maximum salary, employer contribution to retirement, employer contribution to health care contributions, and any other pay for uniform or education. Using that method, we're recommending in the proposed ordinance change, this is the salary survey results. The bottom line is that the Board of Supervisors' pay of total compensation is under market by 14.9%. To look at these results in more detail, the survey agencies are listed on the left-hand side, and there are 15 agencies, including counties and Cal Poly, the school district, the state, and private sector. The next column of comparable classifications, you can see that some survey agencies have a comparable class, some don't. That's very common. That happens throughout the county. There are some classifications where you can't get that same classification in every survey agency. Then going to the right, you see the top monthly salary, then retirement pickup. I want to point out that the San Luis Obispo County retirement pickup, that's Tier 1. Tier 1 retirement pickup is closed now to new employees, and so that's the maximum it would be. If it were Tier 2 or Tier 3, it would be less, like half or more. Then we go to healthcare contributions, average healthcare contribution, and then the far right-hand column shows you total compensation, and that gets you to the bottom line of 14.9% under market. The proposed increase today is for 5%. That's increasing the current annual salary from a little over $82,000 a year to a little over $86,000 a year. That comes out to a little over $4,000 per year per incumbent. If you do the math, it's about $1.95 an hour. The total annual cost is $31,000, a little over that, $31,815. That is salary and benefit roll-up cost, so that is the total cost. The basis for this proposal is listed here. First and foremost, in 2009-10, your board took a voluntary pay reduction of 2.4% to help close the gap that the county was experiencing at that time. As I noted in the previous slide, the board salary is currently 14.9% under market, which is significant. We are aligning with your board's budget policy of, as we're coming out of the 7-year pay plan, we can incrementally add back to services and savings as well as compensation. And recently, your board approved unrepresented employee groups to receive a 2.3% wage increase, and that includes, or in addition to that, a 0.3% increase to go to an equity pool for out-of-market classifications. I would like to note that for unrepresented employees, there was a retroactivity component that is not being recommended for your board today. So the 5% comes from returning the 2.4% pay cut that is still in effect today from 2009-10, and then the 2.6% that was provided to unrepresented employees, the wage and equity increase. So even with this 5% increase, your board salary would remain 9.9% under market, which is still significant. So the recommendation today is to change Ordinance 2.48095 to update the methodology to come into line with other employee organizations to establish market pay, and then to change the annual salary to $86,115.12. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Douglas-Schatz. Do we have any questions of the board for Ms. Douglas-Schatz? Seeing none, I will open it to the public. I do have three requests to speak. We'll start with Mike Brown, followed by Terry Strickland.
Mike Brown, representing CoLab. We think that instead of using these formulas and things that periodically, maybe every 4 years, when there's a general election, the question of board compensation should just be put on the ballot and let the voters determine it. You could have some kind of ad hoc committee that ginned something up that then would go in there. And because it's already a big election, you wouldn't have that much marginal cost. This concept of market is really off base. There's no market for elected officials. I know, and you know, lots of very competent citizens, registered voters out there with large, complex organization experience in their life who would do this for zero. The market for this job is absolutely zero. Market has nothing to do with it at all. I passed out the salary survey to you from, or the clerk, I presume, passed it to you, the San Francisco Civil Service Commission just did it because the question has comes up there, of course. And I refer you to the last page, page 6, which has some of the data from some of the cities. And I always like to point out Oakland, which is a big, complex, very difficult jurisdiction economically and socially, and they're getting the council. Members are getting $74,000 a year. So if you want to look at a market for a tough job as a local legislator, there's one. But moreover, this idea, and this formula is full of these linkages, this whole idea of linking it to what the unions get or, what formulas there are in the civil service system is really dangerous. Your job as local legislators is to be guardians on behalf of the voters of the public purse, of the public interest, and be staunch critics, investigators of the bureaucracy and these systems. And once your salaries and benefits begin to grow, and when you get the fully loaded salary here and the fully loaded cost, you really are having an executive compensation package, you in effect become part of that system. And it undermines your fundamental duty as a guardian to protect people against their government.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Ms. Strickland, followed by Gary Kirkland.
Good morning. Terry Strickland, NAPOMO. So we're here today to talk about raises for the board. For the public that are watching, they might want to get on the internet and go to transparentcalifornia.com, and they can see all of the earnings for people working for our counties, cities, and state government. I was glad to see San Luis County finally provided that information to that website. They were one of the last to do that. Number one, this is not your money. I think that's the most important thing that you need to remember. Santa Barbara County is trying to do the same. Actually, they just did the same thing, gave themselves raises. The only difference was they have a supervisor named Peter Adam, and he was the lone vote against the raise because he did the right thing. In an article in the news press recently, Andy Caldwell stated, "We, the taxpayer, are the only employer on this planet who rewards our employees, that is, those serving in local government, with a retirement benefit that is worth more than the equivalent of their entire lifetime earnings." He also said, "Our community needs to seriously consider why local government employees are paid higher salaries and better benefits than virtually any other employment sector in the country. They enjoy a retirement benefit afforded to only the wealthiest people among us." Andy knows what he's talking about. He's been a government watchdog in Santa Barbara County for over 20 years. He knows their budget inside and out, as one of the few people that have stayed on top of what money, our taxpayer money, being spent for the over 20 years. Number two, we have hundreds of millions of dollars in unfunded liabilities that is not going away. That is your credit card. Your credit card should be declined. This is not your money. Take better care of our money and do the right thing. Vote against this raise. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Strickland. Mr. Kirkland.
Thank you very much. When a private businessman wants to give himself a raise, he doesn't vote like you people do to take money out of the till. He has to work harder. He has to be more productive. He either provides more services or better services or more product or a better product. He can't just vote to give himself a raise. You people are running a business here. We can consider you the owners, and sometimes I think you do think you are the owners of this business, and therefore you can just vote yourself to give yourself a raise. If you want a raise, what I suggest you do, since we are your employers, you come to us, each one of us, and if you want to be fairly effective, you might get a tin can and wear glasses to make it look like you're blind. Come to each citizen of this county and ask them for some money. But it's our money that's going to pay your salaries. Not just vote to change some ordinance that automatically gives yourself some kind of raise. If the citizens of this county think you deserve more money, they'll vote to give you more money, or they'll just give you more money. And then you can learn what it's like to run a private business where you have to work hard to increase your salaries. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kirkland. That was our last request to speak, so I'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board. Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, just so you know, we're taxpayers too. I help pay my salary. But I want to just kind of reflect on what the responsibility is and what's the requirement of a board member. You don't have to like us personally. You don't have to care for what we do in some respects, and that can be decided every 4 years. But in that time frame, we're responsible, along with not just us, but with a lot of staff, to try to determine how we make our budget function in the most effective way. Over the past 6 years, I did some little research with this. We're saving $2.2 million a year because of the annual salary savings of Tier 2 pension, 4.7 because of Tier 3, $3.3 million because of the split pension that we do now with a 50-50 split, and $12.5 million because of flat salaries over the past 5 years, which equates to about $22 million a year. And so when we have to make those decisions, they're not easy, and they're not done just by the board, but the board is collectively tries to try to address that. So I think if you look at that, and then you figure, I figured the same thing on the back of an envelope about if you had a 40-hour work week, which in a lot of cases I'm sure some of our supervisors do not, it's about $1.93 an hour. I think minimum wage went up higher than that. And as far as the public's money, I know school teachers, for example, they probably make more money, and I don't have any say in what they make. That's all done through negotiations outside of my purview. Do I get a say in that? No. So I think that in some cases, I think they have to look at the position, what it's required, what are the requirements of that, and how well has that body functioned. And in my opinion, over the past 6 years, this board has done a pretty darn good job of keeping this county in a pretty good fiscal condition. There was a comment made last week about the deficit of the pension, and I understand that. There is an unfunded liability that will ongoing, and we do address that each year. We did reduced the percentage of the loan that we had on the bonds, refinanced it, is what I was looking for, to save a little bit of money on the bond debt. We did that as well. So I think that over the years, we're trying the best we can to keep this county in a good shape, and I think that the person that made the comment about the debt that other counties have experienced, for example, Oakland and Stockton and other areas like that, pretty much made the case for why we did what we did. And I think that the county is in pretty good shape because of that. So I don't have any reservations about this. I was a very strong supporter of trying to reduce our salary at the very onset, and I think that was the proper time to do it. The county was faced with a huge deficit. So we said we need to take the position of lowering our salaries to take the lead on this. We did that. And I think we've brought the county back a little bit, along with not just us, but with the staff support. So I don't have any reservations about this at all.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham. Ms. Gray.
Further, I think that it's important to recognize that this board has shown and has proven over the last 7 years its ability to manage this county in a fiscally conservative way, and better than most. And we weathered this 7 year pain plan, and the whole county weathered that storm as a result of the leadership of this board. And speaking of the leadership of this board, it is perfectly appropriate that the board was the first in to take a salary cut and the first out to take a salary benefit. And that is precisely the leadership that this county is looking for. On top of that, you know, here I sit. I am the only one of the four that is not going to benefit from this potential increase in salary. So as a taxpayer, why do I want to support this? And I'll tell you exactly why. The reason this board is so well managed is because we've had working professionals here. And this needs to be a salary that allows more than just the retired and the wealthy to be able to serve on this board. And that means that this has to be a real living wage for real professionals who have real world and working experience. And otherwise, that is not available. And to keep up with that is very important. And that speaks to how the HR department has a part of this request today is to change how we look at the market in the same way that we look at all the other positions countywide. And to make that, again, subject to the competition that we know drives a market properly, that I want, as a taxpayer, competition for this job. I want this door to be open to as many citizens as possible and not just a select group of them because they would choose to do it for free, as one of the speakers suggested. I want everyone to have the ability to stand up, serve their county, and do it right in the way that this board has done in the past. So I will be making the motion today to approve.
Without further lights on, I'll accept that as a motion. Do I have a second?
Second.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Meacham. And under discussion, then Ms. Arnold.
Sorry, I was slow with my light there. So I just want to say, I know some of the speakers were addressing the fact that the issue's even been raised, but I believe that it's county policy that obligates our staff to raise this issue and then do the comparables, which I appreciate all this. I guess just the part of me that comes out of the private sector, I know we compare to other counties, and of course that's what you have to compare with, but we don't typically compare the salaries here to the salaries out there in the private sector. So I know that would be probably impossible to do, but I feel Supervisor Meacham is correct. The hourly wage in this job is very low. But and you, all of you supervisors that were here before me, did a very good job of navigating the recession and very responsibly, and so I appreciate that very much. Myself personally, I feel very fairly compensated with this job, and so for me, I'd rather see the money spent on restoring services and programs, especially road maintenance, the thing I harp on all the time, that were scrapped during the recession. So that's just kind of where I'm at, but I totally respect all of your efforts and opinions on this.
Thank you, Ms. Arnold. Mr. Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not to belabor it, I think Supervisor Meacham and Supervisor Ray covered it pretty well, but, you know, three of us that were here at the worst time, six of the 7 years, you were here for 7 years, Mr. Chair, you know, one of the things that I think what is important to look at, and this is a private sector value as well, and there's other private sector values that I couldn't imagine wanting to emulate, such as, you know, destroying pay and benefits and pension for people. You know, we didn't just do what we need to do to balance budget. I mean, we enacted pension and pay reform well before anyone else did, and as Mr. Meacham points out, it's paying off. And our employees, while, of course, nobody likes things like that, worked well with us and cooperated with us and continued to deliver great services. And, you know, we've done a lot of other things continuing to make sure that coming out of the recession, we weren't just okay. In fact, we've come out of the recession with the strongest financial position we've been in you know, maybe ever, in terms of our bond rating, in terms of our ability to put monies back into reserves and to take care of some of the things that we had to defer. Mr. Meacham and I undertook for the first time in the county a strong economic development project, which continues on to this day. So there's a lot of things that we looked at a time when it was very difficult because we had to cut as much as $30 million a year. And, you know, I feel really good. And when there's this comparison made to the public or private sector, I think the thing to keep in mind is that a lot of the practices in the public sector are the exact same things that are destroying the middle class. Stagnant wages, loss of benefits, loss of pension. These are not things that I think the country should want to be emulating. You know, the public sector, which is probably responsible for most of the best jobs in this community, is part of the reason why I think this community actually survived well. The biggest employer in this community, which private employer would be PG&E, actually pays and benefits and pensions their employees quite well. Probably because they want to make sure that they always have high quality. So when the comparison's made, I think it's important for people to keep in mind that the practices of especially, and I'm not talking about the small businesses a lot that we see here, but I'm talking about the companies that a lot of our families, I know my parents used to work for, and others, they have decided that a very small amount of people will make a lot of money. And the rest of the people, and that means most of the people in our country and most of the people in our neighborhoods and most of the families, will make very little money and will have no benefits to look forward to and are expected to save in order to not have to work until they're dead. So I don't make any excuses about the way public employees are compensated and treated. And one of the things that I'm proud of, which Mr. Buckshy continues to insist from his position, is that we are strive to be a world-class organization that delivers great services to our community. And I think that's where we're headed, and I think that's where we'll continue to be headed. So I'm in support of this. I think it's the least we can do. Not for us so much, but as we head back into better times.
Thank you, Mr. Hill, for speaking well to the bigger picture here. I support this motion without reservation. I think Supervisor Ray, in particular, spoke eloquently to the issue for setting this salary at a reasonable rate for the future of this county. And I know there are folks in this county who wouldn't believe for a minute that action taken by this board is about the future and not about our current situation. But I think that, you know, we find over time that we do need to make these incremental changes. I think the hallmark of our efforts through the 7-year pain plan was reasonable, moderate decisions and consistency among employee groups. And this action that we have before us today is completely along those lines. I would note that, to my knowledge, this board was the only five employees in the county who actually took a pay cut. Employees did not get raises, but we reduced our salary. And we are starting to give raises. We have already. And so as we move strategically into the future, I think this is a perfectly reasonable approach. With that, let me just
one quick thing.
Certainly, Mr. Meacham, and then I'll clarify the motion.
So I think that the other thing to recognize, too, when we start talking about the pension and the pension reform, as Supervisor Hill mentioned, we took that on before a lot of others did. And right now, in Tier 2, we have 297 employees in Tier 2. In Tier 3, we have 372. As time progresses, that's cost savings going to increase. So I think that what we're experiencing now is only going to be compounded in terms of savings over the next several years as the demographics change in age and people retire from the county and we have others. And I'm looking at this as far as who's going to sit in this seat next, and I hope that whoever is going to be representing the community well and also being able to be fiscally responsible about it along with that.
Hear, hear. Let me just clarify the motion for the benefit of the clerk with the motion maker and the second, that the motion is to approve the staff's recommended changes to the supervisor's compensation ordinance.
That and the methodology.
And the methodology, and to waive the reading of the ordinance.
Yes.
Seeing agreement on that. And with no further discussion, Madam Clerk, a roll call vote, please.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
No.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. With that, we then come to closed session. I have no request to speak on closed session, so I'll close it to the public, bring it back, and ask counsel for an estimate.
Yes, Reed and Neil, about 15 minutes today.
Very good. We will reconvene at 1:30. Thank you, Madam Clerk. We are back in session, and as is traditional, we will hear from counsel on a report out of closed session.
Rita Neal, County Council. The board did meet in closed session, and no reportable action was taken.
All right. Thank you. I will then entertain a motion on our presentation calendar.
So moved.
Thank you, Mr. Second. Hill. Thank you, Mr. Meacham. And with that, a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Supervisor Ray.
It is my distinct pleasure to recognize Tim Murphy. Tim, can you come on up to one of the lecterns? It is with special fondness that I recognize Tim today. Tim is going to be leaving the Planning Commission, and having served on a Planning Commission myself and understanding how much of the heavy lifting that you do for the Board of Supervisors, it is my great pleasure to read this resolution recognizing you for your service to the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission. So the following resolution is hereby offered and read. Whereas Tim Murphy has served as a planning commissioner from January 2011 through December 2014, representing Supervisorial District Number 4, the best one, conscientiously accomplishing his duties with distinction. And whereas Tim Murphy has played an active role in guiding county planning matters during his tenure in office, providing the Planning Commission with knowledge about the 4th District area. And whereas Tim participated in hearings on the Carrizo Plains solar projects, Shandon Community Plan Update, Jack Reddy Imagination Park, Octagon Barn Project, Highway 1 Realignment, Slo County Energy Wise Plan, the Housing Element Update, Plan Development Ordinance, Disadvantaged Community Plan, the Land Use and Circulation Element of the General Plan, Resource Management System, and numerous General Plan and Ordinance Amendments. And whereas this Board of Supervisors wishes to recognize Tim Murphy's outstanding contributions to the Commission and the residents of Supervisorial District Number 4 and the people of San Luis Obispo County and to county government. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby commend Tim Murphy for his meritorious and conscientious representation of the people of San Luis Obispo County. Be it further resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby wish Tim Murphy continued health and prosperity in his future endeavors.
Mr. Murphy, the lectern is yours.
I'm not used to being on this side of the desk. After she read all those off, you probably know why I'm getting off the commission. I've really enjoyed my time. I appreciate the board's recognition of my service and the time spent there. And 4 years ago, when Supervisor Paul Teixeira approached me about serving on the Planning Commission, I didn't know a lot about its function or purpose or what it did, but I'd been a longtime friend of Paul's and supported him in his campaign, so I felt a little bit of obligation to serve as a planning commissioner. And here 4 years later, I'm really happy I did. I enjoyed my time. It was a real pleasure. I learned a lot about the county, and hopefully we accomplished a few things. It was very busy the first year. I believe we actually met in session more hours than the Board of Supervisors in that year. That's a busy first month. I think we had 7 or 8 meetings instead of 2. So things got going with the Carrizo Plains, but I really enjoyed it. I've worked with a great group of commissioners. Everybody's been hardworking. There's a major time commitment to serving the Planning Commission that goes way beyond what you see during the meetings, as you all know. And everybody was stepped up. We had some really good expertise and hard work. I want to compliment our staff. We have a great planning staff. They're very professional, very prepared. They were very patient when we asked our occasional stupid question, the answer to which was usually on page 3 or 4 of the staff report. But nevertheless, they were very polite to point out what the answer was. And so I really did enjoy it, and I think you've got a good fellow coming in to take my place. And so I wish the county continued success going forward. And again, thank you for the resolution. I appreciate it, and I enjoyed my time.
Mr. Murphy, we have comment from the board here, Supervisor Hill and others.
Tim, I want to thank you personally, and you did have quite a lot of experiences in your tenure, mm-hmm. a lot of projects. Our Planning Commission has been terrific in my time here, and really doing doing what it's designed to do, which is do the heavy lifting on a lot of the planning projects while we do other things. Incredible work that that the commissioners do. You had the honor of serving under two supervisors and continuing to do the work. So, in thanking you, I thank all of the folks, including my own commissioners, who are willing to, because a lot of people don't realize how much the planning commissioners really do, especially when we've had those big projects that you mentioned. So thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Meacham?
Thanks, Tim. I mean, I don't think anybody realizes the time that it takes. Although I see a couple of your colleagues here, my planning commissioner, Jim Irving, asked me, he said, does this take a lot of time? I said, maybe an hour or two out of your week. It's not a bad time. But when Karen mentioned you do the heavy lifting, that's absolutely correct. And we depend so much upon what you do and then the determinations that you make when it gets to us. A lot of times it doesn't get to us because you guys make the call and it's over. And we greatly appreciate that. So thank you for your service, Tim.
Supervisor Ray, I'll give you the last word.
I just wanted to let you know what the planning staff told us about you, Tim, as we asked what they would say about you. And here's what they said. They said that he rarely missed a meeting, and he was low-key and soft-spoken. But when he made comments, they were thoughtful and meaningful, and people listened. We joked that you might be E.F. Hutton in another life. You were considerate of all sides, fair and open-minded, and again, thank you for your service, and you were chair this year, so thank you for chairing, and thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Not really the last word, because Supervisor Arnold, and then I'll comment as well.
I just want to thank you as well. That's the ultimate community service. It's some hard sessions that you all go through, and it does take a lot of work, a lot of thought, a lot of time, and I know that the community really appreciated your service.
Thank you.
Well, as a former planning commissioner, and before I got this job, I thought being on the planning commission was the best gig you could get in public service. I peeked in through the doors last Thursday while you were deep in consideration of one of the couple of high-profile projects we have. All my colleagues have spoken to the heavy lifting and the service you give to communities, you and your colleagues on the commission. It's hard to underestimate how much you all do for the community. How this community looks and how it operates depends so much on the conversations that go on in front of your commission. Let me add my thanks and congratulations on a job well done.
Thank you all.
I am going to read the next one, honoring the retirement of our clerk recorder. And if Ms. Rodewald would step to a lectern, I know you're there. I can see the top of your head. We were speculating in the lobby as to whether this resolution would pass, but it doesn't say anything about accepting the fact you're leaving public service. It's a resolution recognizing you upon your retirement after 33 years. Whereas Julie Rodewald has worked for the County of San Luis Obispo without interruption since January 26, 1981, and will retire on January 4, 2015, just 22 days shy of 34 years. And whereas Julie started her career with the county in the Department of Social Services as an Eligibility Worker 1, she transferred to the Clerk Recorder's Office in August of 1982 as an account clerk. Over the years, she promoted to Legal Process Clerk 2 and 3, Administrative Services Officer 2 and 3, Deputy County Clerk, and in November of 1994, the voters elected her as their County Clerk Recorder, and she has served in this position ever since. And whereas Julie has served on the County Recorders Association of California as Secretary, Vice President, and President of the Association, and on the Board of Directors for the California Association of Clerks and Election Officials, and whereas Julie's role as County Clerk Recorder includes the duties of the Registrar of Voters, in this role she has conducted over 35 elections throughout her career in the most cost-efficient way while still preserving the integrity, security, openness, and accessibility of the election process to the voters of the county. And whereas Julie Staff describes her as, and these are all quotes, always being willing to jump in and assist with serving the public, professional, patient, intelligent, and a role model for those who have had the pleasure to work for her. And whereas Julie will be missed for her incredible leadership and knowledge, her legacy of strong customer service with well-trained, helpful staff will continue in her honor by those she has mentored over the years. Now, therefore, be it resolved and ordered by the Board of Supervisors that Julie L. Rodewald is hereby commended for her 33, let's call it 34 years of dedicated service to the people of San Luis Obispo County, and wished a happy and healthy retirement with many days of leisure with her husband, Rick. Rick as well. Yeah, it's not bad. You know, a four-camera rezzo is it's right up there. Yeah. And Ms. Rodewald, it will surprise you and no one that there are a bunch of people who wish to speak to this item, and I'm going to now recognize various members of the staff and public who wish to talk.
Can I sit down?
Well no, I think it's traditional for you to accept these accolades standing where you are. We'll start with Clerk Recorder-elect Mr. Tommy Gong, followed by Vicki Fogelman.
Great. Thank you very much. Tommy Gong, County Clerk Recorder-elect. But it's been my great pleasure of being the Assistant Clerk Recorder to Julie for the last 9.5 years. And I know I can speak for the entire staff that it has been a great privilege and honor working for Julie Rodewald. She has set high standards of excellence for the department and staff in that we view the public as customers and that we want to provide the best customer service. Last week, I attended a statewide clerks and election officials conference with Julie, and I can tell you that Julie is one of the most well-respected clerk recorders and among the very best in the state. We have been very fortunate to have Julie Rodewald as our clerk recorder for the last 20 years, the longest-serving clerk recorder in our county's history. For us remaining in the office, Julie will be a huge loss. It will be huge shoes to fill, and she has a lot of them. But she has trained us well, and she has set the bar high, so we will continue her legacy of excellence in the future. We wish Julie and only the very best in retirement and future endeavors. Thank you.
Thanks.
Ms. Fogelman, followed by Tammy Bezance.
I'm not looking at her when I talk. Vicki Fogelman. I worked with Julie in the clerk's office from the time she joined the department in 1982 until I left at the end of 2008. We saw a lot of changes and excitement, both good and bad, over the years. We saw the combining of the clerk and recorder's offices, the loss of the Superior Court functions. We handled moves from room 385 to the hallways of the annex building, then back to 385 because of asbestos, then to 1144 Monterey Street, to the old car dealership, and on to the new government center where we all currently live. In 1994, when she ran for the office of clerk recorder, she had the unprecedented support of the entire staff of the work in the office working at that time, and we all worked a lot of hours trying to make sure that she won. She was and still is completely dedicated to the public and her staff, and she never expected anything out of you that she wasn't willing to do herself. She was and will always be not just my previous boss, but my friend. Julie, I wish you many happy years of gardening, golfing, and now we've added traveling and shopping because Rick said we could, and to wonderful places. Maybe now we can get back to dressing up for Halloween. Stay in touch.
It's big to you.
is Vazanz, followed by Vera Wallen.
All right, so I'm not looking at Julie either. First of all, Supervisor Ray, I just want to wish you good luck and thank you for your service to the county, and you will be missed. I started working at the county clerk's office when it was called the county clerk's office before it was the clerk recorder in 1980, so I was there before Julie was. I was actually there with Ms. Beth Wallum was the clerk recorder. I was very young at the time. I've worked with Julie the longest in the department. When she became the county clerk recorder, she was not very familiar with the elections or the recorder's part of the office. She tackled that like she tackles everything else, with a positive attitude and enthusiasm, mastering them both. Julie is exceptional at learning new things, mastering it, and retaining the information. I've had the privilege of watching her grow and mature into an incredible leader and professional. I want to personally thank her for mentoring. She has done a lot of mentoring with me and others over the years. She has taught us that the public matters, that people matter. Because of code sections and rules and regulations, we're not going to make everybody happy, but we can try to make their experience with our office at least a little pleasant. We need to take the time, the extra time, to explain to people why we can't record their documents or file their form, and offer suggestions to where to go to get help. One of the main purposes of our department is public service, and Julie exemplifies that. Julie has always also taken a personal interest in her staff. She walks that line that shows that she cares but is still our boss and is able to make us feel comfortable. She is the leader that we have wanted to follow, and she will be greatly missed. I wish her well on her new journey in life. Thank you.
Ms. Wallen, followed by County Surveyor Doug Ryan.
Hi, and I'll go ahead and look at Julie. I'm talking here for the League of Women Voters and as the Voter Service Chair. And I want to give a special thank you to Julie and to the county, and I'm talking to you all as supervisors here. I think it's important to know that voter service is so important. I know you know that, and I know that Julie knows that. She did a wonderful job, and I know her staff all know about this, and so it's going to continue, encouraging voting and encouraging people to vote. Had clear procedures. That's very important for you to realize as we go into the future. She allowed people to participate in the election process, both at the precincts, with volunteer groups, and there's a bunch of us here that work only during elections that have come to say, fare thee well, lady. So allowing people to participate is really important. And she has a wonderful staff. They are wonderful. And so I know this lucky county is going to be able to continue on with this because we're going to have our staff still together working on this. So, Julie, thank you very much for all your years. The League of Women Voters says go, and we'll continue forward. Board of Supervisors needs to remember all those good things. needs your support.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms.
Bye.
Wallen. You know, if the board could take credit for putting Julie in office, it would. Okay. Believe me, it would be natural. But
if any of you were voters,
the voters of the county. Now, Mr. Ryan, you're not one of these people who the Kirk Recorder's office refused to record their document, are you?
Exactly the opposite. I'm here to publicly express our Doug Ryan, Public Works County Surveyor. I'm here to publicly express our gratitude and appreciation for Julie as the recorder, clerk recorder. Her staff is courteous and professional. I know she'll leave us in good hands. I know that. I've always appreciated working with her. One thing the resolution neglected to mention was what's near and dear to a surveyor's heart is the records of this county, particularly the maps. And the history of our county is stewarded by the county recorder. And next door to us is the history of our county since 1850, and she's a wonderful steward of those records. We've worked together to make those accessible to the public, something I'm very proud of, and without her assistance, it would not have happened. So on behalf of the Public Works Department and the county surveyors that preceded me, thank you very much, and all the best in your retirement.
Thank you, Doug.
Supervisor Ray.
I'm going to start the parade of supervisorial comments with only two words to describe you, Julie. Gold standard. You are the gold standard for elected officials, and I'm getting teary-eyed already, for elected officials in this county. And people will spend their careers trying to do what you've done. So thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Meacham?
There's just no more words. But I remember when I first really got acquainted with Julie, she called me into her office when I got elected as a supervisor and said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Ma'am, you're taking one of my clerks as your assistant now." I'm not happy about that. Yes, ma'am. It's been a great experience, and it's been wonderful to know you. And as Karen mentioned, the standard that you have set, Mr. Gung, you've got a big, big, big job.
Mr. Should we just go down the dais?
Yeah.
And Ms. Arnold.
Thank you, Julie. You've been able to accomplish what everybody would like to, which is to truly leave your department in a great place with a terrific staff. And I remember talking to Tommy about him running for your seat, and I think he had heard the same thing from every single other person that supported him, which was, just tell him you've trained under Julie. You know, you've been her key deputy. And I think that really went a long way. So it's rare, I think, that a clerk recorder or – well, maybe it's rare that any public official these days is accorded with so much respect in our community, but you've earned it. Thank you.
Ms. Arnold?
I'm going to echo a lot of what they said. We have been, as a county, so lucky to have you. So lucky to have you. And you have earned your stellar reputation, and we are going to miss you, but I hope we see you in the halls a lot and often and all around.
You show up here every Tuesday.
Yeah.
And you're welcome to your 3 minutes.
Thank you. I know all of us that have worked with you have really appreciated you very, very much. So
thank you.
Enjoy the retirement.
Thank you.
My colleagues in the public have said it all, but let me sum up perhaps a bit philosophically. One of the measures of our time on this earth is the effect that we have on other people. And there are members of this audience who made it very clear to me and to you that they would not be taking a lectern because they didn't think they could get through comments looking at you or not looking at you. You had that much of an effect on their lives. And I look at your years of service, Julie, and I am in awe. We've heard from people who have felt your presence and have benefited from your being here. I think, as the resolution said, you are going to be in these halls for many, many years to come. And it is the measure of walking into your office and my personal experience there, both as a member of the public, as a candidate, as an elected official. I've never gone in there and heard someone say, "It's not my job. I don't know how to do it. You're going to have to wait." Everybody who we contact there smiles and gets the job done. And as I was walking out of your offices today, I noticed a sign that I've noticed before that is just handwritten, posted up on one of the columns, says, "Let's do it right the first time." And I think that that's so much of who you are and what you've done for this county. I wish you, of course, the very best.
Thank you very much.
And now the lectern is yours.
So I'm almost speechless, which my staff would say is virtually impossible.
We tried.
To be. I appreciate all the kind words from everybody. I have to tell you, I almost feel like a fraud. This has been my dream job. To have the opportunity to serve like I have. We work long, hard hours. It's not always easy, but it's always been, a passion. And I feel so fortunate to have worked with the staff that I've worked with that have helped me make the dream come true. Certainly the support of the administrative office, all of the Board of Supervisors that I've worked for, although I have to say that the current board is the most enjoyable board that I've worked for. Hopefully the other ones aren't sitting behind me in
you
the audience anywhere.
Elected official.
It just has truly been a profound honor and a privilege to be able to serve. in this capacity for 20 years. So that's all. Thank you.
And our last resolution today is also a difficult one to read, as we're bidding farewell to a colleague on the dais here. On behalf of the board, let me read the resolution honoring 4th District Supervisor Karen Ray for her service to the County of San Luis Obispo. Whereas Karen Ray was appointed by Governor Jerry Brown on October 3rd, 2013, to fill the unexpired term of Supervisor Paul Teixeira, and was sworn in on October 4th, 2013. And whereas Karen Ray came to the county with almost a decade of public service after serving as commissioner and chair of the Rio Grande Planning Commission from September 27th, 2005 until May 24th, 2010, then as a council member for the city from May 25th, 2010 until October 3rd, 2013. And whereas during her tenure as supervisor, Karen worked with the Board of Supervisors in passing an urgency ordinance to protect the Paso Robles groundwater basin, delivering a balanced budget and a AAA bond rating for the county, securing open space for the use of all residents by ensuring funding for the Pismo Preserve, and serving as a member of the Workforce Housing Task Force. And whereas as supervisor of the 4th District, Karen reestablished and reinforced the legitimacy and relevance of the community advisory councils, resolved a long-standing dispute at Viva Farms, protected the residents of Mesa Dunes Mobile Home Park by defending their right to proper process, and maintained a policy of openness, fairness, and commitment to constituent service. And whereas Supervisor Ray has left an indelible mark on San Luis Obispo County for years to come by participating in the hiring of new county department heads. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby honor Supervisor Karen Ray for her service to the County of San Luis Obispo and wishes her all the best in her future endeavors. Mr. Hill, Supervisor Arnold, Supervisor Meacham, that's your pleasure, sir.
Thank you. Well, you know, it's we're going to miss Karen. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. When, you know, there's a couple of things that stand out just in the last year and a half, and certainly one was the call about Paul's tragic and sudden death, and then later, you know, trying to figure out who we could talk into applying for the seat with the governor's office. And I was very, very thrilled that Karen decided to do it. It's an incredibly difficult thing to do. I can't think of anybody who's done it with the grace and the extraordinary competence. It's hard to appreciate what a difficult experience it is to come into this job. Coming to this job under those circumstances, you know, some time had passed, but nonetheless, it's very difficult. And Karen has done so many things that the public is aware of, and a lot of things that maybe the public isn't aware of. I think that the board is stronger and certainly more collegial and certainly looking ahead with more resolve and a greater sense of cooperation because of Karen. And that's hard to replace. So, you know, I have nothing but just great respect for her as a leader in our community and great fondness as a friend.
Yeah, thank you. And I just want to say your dedication to your community is very commendable. All the work and time you put in and devote to this job. And I just want to thank you for your service as well.
you came here with energy. Mr. Meacham, are you ready to talk?
I'm ready.
In CLI? You go.
It's difficult. I mean, you've not only become a great colleague, but a good friend. And you're always on my right. And I don't think that we're going to, this is the end of seeing Karen Ray. I think that there's a she's got too much in front of her. She's too knowledgeable. And as Mr. Hill mentioned, you can't step into this position on a short notice and just sit in this seat and start making determinations without really digging into the issues and making yourself educated on the topic. She did that. She did it with grace. She did it with style. She did it with leadership. I'll miss you.
And Ms. Ray, before I comment, I have to give you the rest of the package that came with the resolution.
Thank you.
And I would only add, you know, colleagues have spoken to the extraordinary circumstances by which you joined us here. You came with confidence. You came with energy. You came with an immense reservoir of work ethic and hard work, and just brightened this place up. And for that, we thank you. I too wish you well, and have the same suspicions as Mr. Meacham, is that we're going to hear from you again before too long.
Thank you so much. I did take the time to write a few things because I was afraid I was going to stumble, and I'm still afraid to stumble because clearly some phone calls were made and some of my most dearest friends are here in the audience today. So thank you for taking time to come, and thank you, Board, for this resolution. They kept this secret for me. I didn't know that this was happening until I read my packet on Sunday. So before I go any further, I want to thank my family. When someone steps up to serve, their family does too, and mine has been incredible. Oh, gosh, here we go with the waterworks. thank you. first and foremost, yeah. Though they're at school, I'd like to publicly thank my children, Caleb and Aaron, who walked this road with me and learned more about how the world works than most people will learn in a lifetime. And they will be better men because of it. They grounded me during a tumultuous year and constantly reminded me that love drives all I do. And to my partner, Randy, who made sure to hold me up during the most trying of times and who endured hours of conversation on policy and politics and listened more than anyone could reasonably be asked. It's hard to try and sum up this experience in only a few moments, so I thought I'd use this time to hopefully inspire others to serve. Why would anyone throw their hat into this unforgiving world of politics? And why should you, those of you sitting at home, or who I'm talking to right now? 10 years ago, I was at a dinner party, and I was approached by a public official, much like Mr. Murphy, who asked if I was interested in serving on the Planning Commission. I was a stay-at-home mom at the time, and my first question was, what's a Planning Commission? And after 2 weeks of watching meeting tapes and talking to people, I decided to take the plunge. And what the heck? The worst that would happen is that I would hate it and I would go home. I fell in love at my first meeting. I had a real hand in shaping the town I grew up in. The look of the buildings, the way the traffic moves, the way neighborhoods feel. Land use affects everything about our daily lives, and I could make lives better in my city at every single meeting. When I had the chance to expand that reach at the city council level, I thought long and hard about a more visible life. I didn't know just how visible I was going to get. I loved my council job. I had a much larger hand in policymaking, land use, public safety, and financial planning. And working alongside staff and community members, we'd moved the town forward while preserving its historic character. And it was a careful balance that required finesse and vision and professionalism. And I learned the true meaning of public service. And the price I paid was worth it. And then this adventure came. This time, as I weighed whether to step up, I knew much more about what the increased visibility would mean, not only for me, but for my family. I knew this would be unforgiving. I knew the attacks were coming. I knew I would be stopped at the grocery store in my sweats on a Sunday morning. I knew I would see my name in the paper and not always with the positive tone I would hope for. And I knew all those risks. So why did I do it? And why should you do it? Why would anyone do this job and suffer the inevitable negativity? And I'll tell you why. I've never had such an opportunity and privilege to help people on this scale. Whether it's helping individuals with individual homeowner issues or developing policies that will translate into well-designed communities where we raise future generations of citizens and leaders, or ensuring the fiscal strength of the organization, or preserving open space and resources in our quality of life, or lobbying in Sacramento on behalf of our citizens, I've had the chance to make so many lives better, not only now, but for years to come. And even when most of the 250,000 plus citizens don't even know what we do, it's enough to fall asleep at night knowing I've done good every single day. And the negativity is tiny in comparison. It's kind of like parenting. Our kids never know the lengths to which we'll go to keep them safe, and the same feeling of satisfaction is true of being a public official. I sincerely hope that all the people listening at home will give my words today careful thought. After all, every public official, whether local or state or federal, started in the very same place that you listeners are starting right now at home. They listened, they wondered if they really could, and they decided to step up. Everyone's reasons are different, but we're all just regular people trying to make a difference. There's no X-Men school of public service. You just get up and you try, and that's all. You get the hang of it, I promise, and you just might do something really, really great. And all this being said, no supervisor acts alone, and I could not be more proud of my office and the service we've provided to District 4 and the county. I want to be sure to highlight the best decision I made for my district. It was the first decision I made as supervisor, and that was to bring on Elizabeth Ruth as my legislative aide. Liz, can you come to the lectern, please? Okay, I can't look at her. To use a football analogy, if I'm the quarterback of District 4, then Liz is the running back. I'm working the whole field and affecting the big picture, and Liz moves the ball forward every single day in increments that look like a yard here and a yard there that end up in touchdowns. She is professional at all times. She genuinely cares about serving each and every constituent with the highest regard for quality and attention to detail. I'm sure you can see right now, manifested in her ever-perfect posture, that signifies her integrity and her intelligence. There are simply not enough words to thank her for the countless things she's done for this county and to make our lives better.
And Liz shakes a couple more hands, and before she sits down, on behalf of the board, I'd like to present Liz, or show Liz, where it is that her service is going to be remembered. And a lot of folks haven't noticed this, but just inside the main door to our office suites is a list of all those who have served as legislative assistants since that job started in the early 90s. The plaque reads, San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors, Legislative Assistants, with gratitude to a group of exceptional people for your caring service to the board, the county, and our community. Liz, I mean, in terms of exceptional people, you are right up there at the top of that. A woman who can fly jet airplanes and handle phone calls about potholes has range. And so what I'd like to do is just formally hand this over the dais, and your colleagues, I'm sure, will help you get it back up on the wall. We are going to recess to the lobby to have a little conversation with those that we have so honored. So, Liz, thank you. Karen, thank you. And we'll be 15, 20 minutes. We'll be back in session. Thank you, ma'am. We are going to reconvene at this point and ask Madam Clerk to introduce our next item.
Item number 25, submittal of a resolution adopting certain policies and procedures set forth in the Low Reservoir Response Plan for the San Luis Obispo County Flood Control and Water Conservation District, Zone 3, authorizing the Director of Public Works to implement the Low Reservoir Response Plan and finding that the project is exempt from Section 2100 of the California Public Resources Code, CEQA, District 4.
Very good. Mr. Hutchinson.
Mr. Yep. Chairman, members of the board, Mark Hutchinson, County Public Works Deputy Director. This is a discussion of the Low Reservoir Response Plan for Zone 3 in the South County. There we go. The map on the overhead shows Zone 3, the entire boundary. Within Zone 3, the Lopez Project provides treated water to the cities of Arroyo Grande, Grover Beach, and Pismo Beach, the Oceano Community Services District, and multiple customers within County Service Area 12, which is Avila Beach and the Avila Valley. That includes the Avila Beach Community Services District. The Low Reservoir Response Plan, which was originally created in 2007 and adopted by the board, as part of a larger document that was devised to manage the reservoir in the interim period while we work on the habitat conservation plan, was created to manage downstream releases and the municipal diversions, that is, deliveries to our customers, from the reservoir during periods of low reservoir storage, with a focus of preserving the water, that is, continuing to provide water service to those communities for at least 3 and potentially 4 years. The Low Reservoir Response Plan has certain enactment triggers. It goes into effect when the Board of Supervisors, acting as the San Luis Obispo County Flood Control and Water Conservation District, declares an emergency that includes Lopez Reservoir. The Board did proclaim an emergency in the spring of this year, and that remains in effect. The other trigger is when the reservoir drops below 20,000 acre feet in storage. I can report to you today that we have dropped below the 20,000 acre foot number. I'll give you the details momentarily. So the initial prescribed actions, what happens if the board adopts the resolution today? We would reduce entitlement water deliveries, that's municipal deliveries. I'll show a table on that. We reduce downstream releases. There would be no new allocations of surplus water from unreleased downstream. As you'll recall, the contracts work so that water that's not released downstream and is held in the reservoir is available for the municipalities in the following water year based on their entitlement contract percentages. Per the Low Reservoir Response Plan, that would not occur. That water would be saved in the reservoir and used for subsequent drought years for municipal deliveries. But at the same time, we would extend the time that agencies can take deliver of their own unused water. Normally, that water zeroes out at the end of the water year, which is at the end of March. Under the Low Reservoir Response Plan, essentially creates a carryover account for each of our water customers. These are the initial prescribed actions, the reductions in municipal deliveries. You can see when we go below 20,000 acre feet, the municipal diversion reduction is zero, which sounds like not much. But what's really happening there is the surplus water provisions are taking effect. And the key one, again, is not accounting unreleased downstream water into surplus water accounts for use. Should the reservoir drop to more historic levels, you can see that the reductions that would follow. These are not annual reductions. They would go into effect at the point in time that the reservoir releases those levels. Although we are in historic drought, unprecedented in the Lopez watershed, I should point out that the reservoir's previous low was just above 16,000 acre feet in storage. So we are not yet into uncharted territory. On the downstream release side, we have these numbers, which are on a different kind of schedule from the municipal deliveries. Our technical advisory committee and advisory committee for Zone 3 work very closely with area farmers, especially those in the Rio Grande Valley upstream of the city, where they are very dependent on stream flow to maintain their agricultural businesses. We adjusted these numbers, what looks like in an odd way, but what we're doing is making initial reductions from 4,200 downstream to 3,800, which we know from recent work with the farmers is the minimum amount of water needed to maintain the current level of irrigated agriculture during a drought period. We're able to do that for 2 years. The farmers would report that numbers below 3,800 make their business infeasible. So in a continued drought, we would expect that irrigated agriculture in 3 years from now or below 10,000 acre feet would be put on hold. We would then be making downstream deliveries of about 1,000 acre feet to support groundwater recharge and habitat maintenance within the stream. The 300 number, which we hit at 5,000, reflects what's called the pass-through amount. Our water permit allocation surface water diversion permit from the state requires that whatever flows in during the four dry months, June, July, August, and September, is released at the same rate from the dam. And historically, that would the average would be about 1,000 acre feet. And then at 5,000, we drop to the 300 number. Actually, the 300 number is the pass-through amount. The 1,000 is the difference between the upper and lower, is where we're going with that. At 4,000 acre feet, again, we would drop to straight pass-throughs, and in the event there was no inflow in the reservoir, there would be no releases. And at some point near 4,000 acre feet, the water falls below the outlet works, and we're unable to make releases. This is just one of the graphs from the low reservoir response plan, some of the studies that were done. We compared the various operating scenarios to recent drought events. So you can see there the red line is last year's inflow and rainfall, April 1st through March 31st. If that year were to repeat, the reservoir would operate under the low reservoir response plan for 2 years. I can tell you that year we're substantially ahead of where that was. And then various combinations of other water years. The green line is interesting. That's the average of the last 3 years of inflow and rainfall. So we had more in 11-12 and 12-13. On the green line, we could extend the operation of the reservoir out to 4 years, which is a good number for that depth of drought. Extended delivery provisions, these are found in the LRRP and actually don't relate to anything that we currently have in our water supply contracts, hence all of the work with the agencies to make this happen. But what that does is each agency would be responsible for managing their own Lopez water account. So at the end of the water year, if they had saved water below their entitlement or surplus from the previous, that would accrue to that individual agency. As you'll recall from our discussion for CSA 12 a couple of months ago, that is important to the Avila Valley because for most of those agencies, Lopez is their only water source. And their allocations are such that they do have extra water, so they start building a reserve account. In the event we went all the way down to near 4,000 acre feet, Avila would still have some water where the other agencies would be shifting back onto groundwater supplies, which, although limited, is a backup supply. And then, of course, if an agency were to store its own water in Lopez, they would also have to pay the evaporation loss or the additional evaporation loss from having that water in the lake. That is, if you put more water in the lake, the surface area is larger, so the evaporation tends to be slightly higher. It's a small amount, but the fact of the matter is we do measure that. I have a technical advisory committee full of technical people, and when you put math problems in front of them, they take advantage of that. So we have evaporation losses there. Some of the previous actions with the low reservoir response plan, it was at the Zone 3 Advisory Committee in September in its current form as a public review draft. They recommended running it through all of the Zone 3 agencies and CSA 12. You can see the list there. Grover Beach was first. They took the concept and took it public. It was endorsed by their council, and then they followed up on November 17th with a resolution. I need to point out for the record that the resolution from City of Grover Beach in your staff report is stamped draft. We received that before it went to their council. I have it on good authority that was approved in that form. And when we receive an actual signed copy, we'll add that to the record. On November 20th, the Advisory Council again looked at all of the resolutions from those various agencies and then recommended to your board adoption of the low reservoir response plan in the form that is in your staff report. That is, without changes throughout this entire process. So if you adopt the resolution today, it will put us on a schedule to reduce municipal deliveries based on reservoir levels, downstream deliveries the same. It would eliminate surplus derived from unreleased downstream. That water would not accrue to any individual agency but would remain in the reservoir for low reservoir response plan use in following years. But each agency would have the opportunity to save water that they otherwise would be entitled to in the reservoir and carry it over into following years. The low reservoir response plan also has an adaptive management component, which is actually on the next slide. In this little box right here in that flow chart that's in your staff report, there may be situations where the technical advisory committee identifies the need for adjustments to the way we're operating the reservoir. Some slight changes in the numbers based on could be upcoming climate, rainfall predictions, could be how Lopez is relating to the groundwater basin that also serves the same communities. In that event, they would recommend adjustments to the advisory committee, which is built in an appeal process to the board. But since your board's adopting solid numbers, we need some degree of flexibility, so the resolution includes a paragraph that authorizes the Public Works Director to approve on your behalf adjustments in those numbers, as recommended by the TAC and the Advisory Committee, of up to a 10% variance from the numbers that you're adopting today. We're also recommending that you find the low reservoir response plan exempt from CEQA. It is exempt two ways, both statutorily and in the CEQA, state CEQA guidelines, as an ongoing water supply emergency, as also an ongoing reservoir operation. There's the recommendation, straight from the staff report. Normally I would end there, but I need to show you this. This is one of the summary tools that the Technical Advisory Committee uses. It's produced by our Utilities Division staff. And it's a record. The solid green line on the left is reservoir levels this year. The blue bars are 10-year average rainfall amounts for those months. And this illustrates a little bit about what's happening with adaptive management. The reservoir yesterday at 20,678 acre-feet. Today, 20,683, a 5-acre-foot gain. But 1,035 acre-feet of that water is stored state water. So we are at 19,648.5 acre-feet as of 8 o'clock this morning, or triggering the reservoir low reservoir response plan. At the same time, notice this number right here, 2.11. That's the 10-year average rainfall at Lopez Dam. As of yesterday, we were at 3.28 inches at Lopez Dam, or 155% of normal. So you can see as this reservoir floats around the 20,000-acre-foot level, the Technical Advisory Committee and county staff together will be tracking those numbers and making recommendations through the advisory committee on how exactly to implement the low reservoir response plan. We are seeing some inflow and some increase in the reservoir, not as dramatic as Nacimiento, for example, but it is slightly trending upward with this rain. With that, I'll answer any questions that you may have or attempt to do so.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hutchinson. Questions of Mr. Hutchinson? Mr. Meacham.
Just one, Mark. You mentioned the current level and the amount coming in. What about evaporation?
We, evaporation on Lopez Reservoir is variable. I just have in my head the average numbers. which is at these reservoir levels around, you know, at the 20, 25,000 acre feet, we'll lose somewhere between 6 and 7 feet of elevation off the reservoir due to evaporation, which can be a substantial number. However, that's calculated into the reservoir safe yield,
okay,
upon which the low reservoir plants plan is based.
Thank you.
And my question, which I think I know the answer to, but I'd like confirmation, the low reservoir response plan really amounts to an agreement between the beneficiaries of the water in this reservoir. I mean, as I looked at it, I could, you know, say, well, are we being aggressive enough, or are we allowing enough to go downstream? We could do, you know, one or the other. But this is the water that belongs to these agencies that are, and the county's CSAs that are contractors, essentially, or users of that water. And so it would seem to me that to the extent that they agree on how this reservoir is to be managed, that's really all that matters, because it's their water supply that we are managing as the flood control district.
Well, I think that's key to the low reservoir response plan, is the degree to which all of the municipalities and various customers are participated in its development, and not only the municipalities, and they look at the reservoir as part of their water portfolio, whether they have groundwater and or state water, and understanding their own communities' needs, where they are in their conservation plans. But that same group also reached out and invited all of the Valley farmers, which at the same time are members of those communities, although they work in the Valley, to put this plan together. County staff provided technical information, and then ultimately we brought on a consultant, Water Systems Consulting, to take it to another level and test some of our theories and ideas and build a higher level of confidence in the team. So we have a very collaborative and very well-supported program here.
Right. Very good. With that, and no further questions for staff, I will open it to the public. I have a couple of requests to speak. Mr. Paavo Ogren, followed by Greg Ray.
Chairman Gibson, members of the board, Paavo Ogren, General Manager for Oceano Community Services District, and the recommended action for adoption of a resolution for the Lopez Low Reservoir Response Plan is supported by the Board of Directors of Oceano. Clearly, your points just made were the ones that I was going to make, which is that it is an excellent example of collaboration between local agencies, helps to promote well-governed, safe, livable, healthy communities.
Oh, you learned something while you were here.
And, yeah. And specifically, the extension of time to use water that's been allocated helps to promote, on a wholesale basis, water conservation. In addition to reaching out to the agricultural community, I know I did get a couple of calls from environmental groups who had looked at the document. They're not here today because they also recognized the benefit of trying to conserve water during this drought. And so, on behalf of Oceano, we urge support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ogren. Mr. Ray?
Good afternoon. Greg Ray, Public Works Director, City of Grover Beach. I really have very little to say in that thank you, your staff, for working with the Zone 3 Technical Advisory Committee as well as the Advisory Committee itself. In coming up with a document that we think and a program that we think is very supportable and certainly involved a lot of collaboration, and I think we're definitely behind this. So appreciate if you continue with this item and adopt it as recommended. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Ray. No other requests to speak and no one coming forward. We'll close public comment, bring it back to the board. Supervisor Ray.
I just wanted to highlight the fact that the gentlemen from Oceano and from Grover Beach are being kind to our staff, but all of those groups working together, this was no small thing. This is months and months and months of work in a very politically charged environment over water, as we all know. And the fact that we have all gotten to consensus, and you saw that list from Mark on the staff report showing that it had been through all the other advisory and city councils with complete agreement, is, again, something that our staff should be commended for, that the TAC and the advisory committee should be commended for. And so I will enthusiastically support the motion today.
Second.
You're going to make the motion.
Sure, I'll make it and support it.
And support it. Excellent. Thank you.
I support it at all. Second.
Yeah, right. So thank you, Ms. Ray and Mr. Hill. With no further discussion, and thanks to staff and all the member agencies, I'll ask Madam Clerk for a roll call, please.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Thank you. And when you're ready, a introduction of the next item, please.
Item number 26, a hearing to adopt the annual road improvement fee reports for fee areas of Avila, Los Osos, South County, Templeton, North Coast, and San Miguel, all districts.
Thank you. Afternoon, Mr. Marshall.
Good afternoon, Supervisor Gibson.
There we go. It's been a while since I've been up here.
Yeah. Well, welcome back.
Good afternoon, Chair Gibson and Supervisors. I am Glenn Marshall with the County Public Works Department. I have with me Michelle Mattson. She's the lucky recipient of having to prepare the short straw of doing the one-year update to our six circulation studies. So I'm just going to let Michelle give her presentation, and we will be available for comments.
Thank you. Ms. Mattson.
Sounds good. Yeah,
Base of the mic, Michelle.
Michelle Mattson, County Public Works, here to present the annual road improvement fee reports for the 13-14 fiscal year, which ran between July 1st, 2013 and June 30th, 2014. Purpose of road improvement fees is to estimate the cumulative traffic impacts under build-out of the general plan. Following analysis of a travel demand model, mitigation measures are identified per the board's level of service policy, and a fair share fee consistent with government code section 66,000 is developed and payment is required prior to permit issuance. We currently have six fee areas: Avila, Cambria, Los Osos, Nimpomo, San Miguel, and Templeton. In San Luis Obispo County, the program was initiated in 1989 and has collected over $46 million and helped fund the following projects: San Luis Bay Drive Bridge Replacement, Los Osos Valley Road Widening, Cary Avenue Extension, Teft Street Operational Improvements, Willow Road Extension and Interchange Project, Vineyard Interchange Project, Los Tablas Road Interchange, Bennett Way Extension, and then multiple traffic signals, left turn lanes, and other capacity improvements in those communities. Here are the road improvement fee account summaries for Southern San Luis Obispo County, being Avila, Los Osos, and Nimpomo. Avila saw 18 building permits subject to fees, Los Osos saw none, and the Nimpomo areas had 41 building permits subject to fees. There were no fee appeals for these areas during 13-14. In Nimpomo Area 1, the need to borrow a little over $18,000 from Area 2 to cover some of the Willow Road costs with closing out that project. Here are the current road improvement fees for Southern San Luis Obispo County. Currently, no fee changes are proposed. In 2015, we'll be updating the Avila and Nimpomo circulation studies, and fee changes should be anticipated during those larger updates. The circulation study updates and summary of the data you saw in these last two slides is included in the staff report, and it contains additional information on each fee area. The updates also contain a multimodal component, which was requested by the board during previous updates to the studies. And I do want to note that the South Bay Dial-A-Ride is no longer in service. Here are the road improvement fee account summaries for Northern San Luis Obispo County, Cambria, San Miguel, and Templeton. Cambria saw five building permits subject to fees, San Miguel 2, and Templeton 24. There was one fee appeal during fiscal year 13-14 in Templeton Area A, and this fee appeal was denied. The Templeton expenditures also include certificates of participation for the Vineyard Drive Interchange Project, and Area AB did need to borrow $74,000 from the road fund this year to cover those certificates. And here are the current road improvement fees for those areas. Again, no changes are proposed with this update, and the Templeton circulation study will also be updated in 2015. Current capital improvement projects being pursued under the RIF are the Avila Beach Drive Interchange, Halcyon Road and State Highway 1 intersection, Teff Street Interchange Phase 2, and Main Street Interchange in Templeton. The 2014 circulation study updates were presented to each community advisory council, and no changes were requested. The program has been reviewed with the Economic Vitality Group, and the updates were available for public review. Per Government Code 66,000, it does require five-year Nexus study updates, and Avila, Nimpomo, and Templeton will be done in 2015, as mentioned. Glenn's going to discuss SB 743.
So just to confuse, otherwise what would have been a perfect presentation, clear and concise, the government code about the end of 2013 passed Senate Bill 743, which takes what we presently do with our RIF. It's based on capacity, which is levels of service and delay, and that's how we come up with future mitigations and how we mitigate for future cumulative development. Well, the new Senate Bill 743 will kind of add on to that by looking at vehicle miles traveled and reducing greenhouse gas. And it's supposed to provide a benefit in assisting with trying to speak as a planner now, and I'm only an engineer.
In making your head hurt?
It does. It's just, that's why, luckily, I've got Tim over here to keep me honest on this. But in general, I think the big thing that we need to know about Senate Bill 743, if you've heard anything about it, is it will be a new way to look at the mitigation requirements for traffic impacts associated with new development. However, it will not supersede the government code, Section 66,000, which is the fee mitigation plan. And all that means is the RIF fees that we're presenting to you today, you'll be seeing these for years to come. It won't be going away. Instead, they'll just be adding a different mitigation or a different analysis for CEQA, which on top of the RIF fees. Now, Tim can probably explain that in about three words and much clearer than I did, but that's the general essence of Senate Bill 743.
We'll see if the board has got it as clear as we think we do.
Okay.
Change is coming. All right. Recommendations.
Recommendation. Receive the 2014 road improvement fee reports and adopt the resolutions continuing the fees for the road improvement fee programs in Avila, Los Osos, Nimpomo, North Coast, which is also known as Cambria, San Miguel, and Temple.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Mattson. Mr. Meacham.
Yeah. I have a question in regard to the trying to understand what you said, Glenn. I think I got it. But when we're talking about the greenhouse gas emission and vehicle miles traveled relative to fees, if there is more, I guess, hybrid cars, if there's more electric stuff like that, the emissions are less. How does that relate to the fee structure relative to vehicle miles traveled?
This is kind of a new concept for us, and I don't know if I have a good answer at this point, but over the coming months we'll be working with County Council and other agencies, including SLOCOG, to develop, to understand basically this new Senate bill, how it's applicable, and we'll even be getting planning involved. But now I'm looking over to Tim, and he may have a good answer to you.
No, I think Glenn's done a great job. I'm Tim McNulty with the County Council's office, and you all probably realize that the legislature has determined that the way CEQA looks at traffic impacts has got to change, and we're moving away from creating more capacity, and we're looking at a means of reducing vehicle miles traveled. So if we continue to collect road improvement fees and apply those to capacity, we'll actually be doing some sort of CEQA review on that capacity increase. On top of that, as an individual project comes forward, increasing capacity is no longer going to be an adequate mitigation for traffic. There's going to need to be some demonstration of how the project mitigates for vehicle miles traveled that it creates. And that's really what we're going to be grappling with. Does that mean that we have two fees now? Does that mean that we, you know, alter one fee to account for the other? Or just how do we deal with that? And that's what we're going to be doing.
Supervisor Ray?
I was clear until we got to the end there, Glenn. So to put this into layman's terms, what the state is doing with this new legislation is basically saying rather than making room for more cars, what we really want to do is have less cars on the road.
In essence, I think they'll be favoring development that promotes reduction in greenhouse gases, which is infill development.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.
And my understanding of it is that the CEQA analysis and mitigation fairly directly or indirectly affects the cost of projects. And so when we work up a nexus study, we have to apportion the cost of projects over potential beneficiaries, new development of those projects. And so I think it really comes in on the cost line. And perhaps in the choice of projects in terms of their cost efficiency would be how I would see that happening. Is that?
Well, I think the one thing that that I'm still working on is, you know, we've always used the CEQA analysis as the basis for imposing road improvement fees on projects, not on individual small houses, but certainly on the larger projects. It's really been an analysis of how will this project reduce road capacity. And then we've asked them to mitigate that by contributing to a fund.
To increase road capacity, and now we've got to somehow.
So now, you know, if increasing road capacity isn't mitigating your impact, you're going to have to find some other way to do it. And you might need to be doing both things at the same time if you still want to have a road improvement fee account.
So. Good. There'll be reason to meet on this again. This just sounds good. I don't have any requests to speak. Seeing no one coming forward, I'll close it to the public and bring it back to the board. We are under the old school at this point, so I would entertain a motion on staff's recommendation.
About a couple of Mr. and Mrs. Larice want to build a home in the Pomo on this site. During their testimony, they just happened to mention for the first time that there used to be a home on this lot. Staff was able to verify that, yes, in fact, there was a home on this lot. It was there in 1990 when our RIF program was put in place, or in 91 actually, but we know it was there in 1990. We know that it was removed in 2010 with the assistance of code enforcement. And so therefore staff was able to deem that this is actually a replacement home. Being a replacement home, there's no new traffic generated, therefore no new fee should be required. All that boils down to is that the calculated fee for this development is $0, which puts you in the precarious spot of neither needing to waive it or deny it, the appeal. When I explained that to the appellant, they agreed to withdraw their appeal, and that's what they've done. However, they have asked that they would get their appeal fee of $497 back. And so that is still an action requested of this board at this time. So to make that as short and sweet as I could, I recommend you take no action on the appeal, but refund the appeal fee to the appellant.
Thank you. Ms. Ray, question?
Not question, but just to say, I just wanted to say a special thank you to Supervisor Meacham, who immediately caught that the import of the fact that there had been a mobile home there would maybe throw a good monkey wrench into the issue. And so it is by his doing that we got here. So thank you. And with that, I'd like to make the motion to follow staff's recommendation.
Second. We'll take the motion and Mr. Meacham's second. I don't have any requests to speak on the item. I will open it to the public, and seeing no one coming forward, I'll close the public, bring it back to the board, and now we can do this on a voice vote. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, none. Done. Thank you, Mr. Endicott. And Madam Clerk, would you introduce our last item of the year, please? Well, almost our last item of the year, but our last item of the day. It's not our last item of the year, actually. My mistake.
Item number 28, a hearing to consider a request by the County of San Luis Obispo to approve cleanup amendments to the Real Property Division Ordinance, Title 21 of the County Code, and the Land Use Ordinance, Title 22 of the County Code, as follows. Amendments to Title 21 to 1, update the names of the planning areas and their sub-areas that correspond to each fee zone for parks and recreational facilities, and 2, require that the applications for land divisions include justification for any request to receive partial credit against required Quimby fees for land divisions that provide unable common open space for park and recreational purposes, and amendments to Title 22 to include Section 22.30.480, residential uses in the agricultural land use category, in the specific use standards for single-family dwellings, and 2, replace references to the Uniform Building Code with the California Standards Code. Amendments are exempt from CEQA, and take final action on all the items previously given tentative approval on December 2nd.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. Ms. Griffin, a great pleasure to have you with us one more time.
One last time. And appropriately, it's the general plan amendment cycle. So this is day two of the winter general plan amendment cycle. You do have one item that you'll take a public hearing on and take tentative action. And then you'll be able to take final action on this item, depending on the action you take tentatively, as well as the two items that you previously gave tentative approval to on the second. And with that, I'll turn it over to Brian Pedrotti, who will do your staff presentation.
Mr. Pedrotti.
Good afternoon, Chairman Gibson and members of the board. Brian Pedrotti. As Ms. Griffin said, there are three sets of projects in slightly different stages of hearing. One is the cleanup revisions to Title 21, the Real Property Division Ordinance. They were introduced on December 2nd, and that will be final action today. There's the cleanup revisions to Title 22, the Land Use Ordinance, with hearing and final action today. And then tentative action on the December 2nd items and final action today on general plan amendments, the resource management system update, and the public facilities to commercial retail, which is formerly the Cambria Library. And staff will provide a presentation on just the cleanup amendments today and then bring it back to the board for final action on all the items. So the cleanup items, periodically staff identifies minor cleanup revisions to the county ordinances. And staff has identified a package of cleanup revisions within Title 21 and Title 22 out in each land use category. And it just should have been there, and now we're adding it right down here. It's kind of a very small addition there, 480. And then our final Title 22 amendment is the California Building Code standards. We're replacing the references to the Uniform Building Code with the California Building Standards Code. The UBC ceased to exist, I believe, in 2007, and the county adopted the California Building Standards Code in 2008 with several revisions since then. So really, this is just changing the name in our code. And the staff recommendation is to hold the hearing on the minor cleanup amendments to Titles 21 and 22 recommended by the Planning Commission and take final action on those minor cleanup amendments, the RMS update, and the formerly Cambria Library General Plan Amendment from public facilities to commercial retail, and then adopt and sign the attached resolution and ordinances. And that concludes our presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Pedrotti. One question I have about the building code reference, the California Building Standards Code, it seems I remember we adopt specific local modifications to that, and is that covered under the reference as it's put into the land use ordinance at this point?
Yes, so the references in the land use ordinance really reference back to our local ordinances, so it's fine, and we do adopt a local version of those.
Okay, very good. Any other questions for staff?
Yeah.
Yes, Ms. Arnold.
I do. I was looking, so on attachment 1E, which is page 1 of 3 on the attachment, the staff report. In Section 3, level of severity 3 in communities with a certified level of severity 3 for water supply. That's number 2 on the in Section 3.
Is that on the RMS system, Supervisor?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Look, if we could get our tentative motion on these, and then we can go back if you'd
okay.
like and talk
sure.
about talk about that. But this is a specific. We've already taken tentative action on the RMS system and the rezoning up in Cambria. Let me ask if there are questions to staff on that. I'm going to go ahead and open it to the public. We can come back under discussion on the other. With that, I'll open it to the public on this item. I have three requests to speak. We'll start with Greg Graywall, followed by Mike Brown.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Greg Graywall, Creston. My concern is with the building code changes. I didn't realize that the UBC ended in 2007 and we picked up something else. But I was concerned that there isn't anything in the paperwork that I received that shows what the differences are. And being somebody that built it, I've built every home I've lived in. I got 12,000 square feet of structures on my ranch. I built all the homes. I went through the building system. Unlike getting the $497 back like the other guys did, they lost my plan for 4 months after I sat waiting for 8 months to be able to turn them in so I could get it. And every time, I don't know how most people do, I build everything at my place. I do the electrical, the plumbing, the framing, the cement work, build all the cabinets. And when I got my permit in 03, you had to have an inspection every 6 months. Somewhere later in that, because it took me a while to finish two houses I was building by myself that added up to almost 12,000 square feet, that I had to be done by a certain date, that they changed it where you had it. And I didn't understand that when a person is doing their work and they're an owner-builder and it's their money they're putting out and they're helping the community by buying materials and doing all the things that they do, that there should be a date certain that you have to be in your place or you have to get an extension or something like that. I never could understand that. But I'm always concerned when they start changing things that you can do on your property, because I can have so many ag buildings because of my cattle, or I can do this or I can do that. And then 5 years later, they tell you that you can't do something. And the reason I bought the piece of property that I bought was so I could do these different things over the course of my retirement so that I could live my life the way I wanted to live my life. So I'm real concerned whenever they want to change the building rules, because I no longer think it should be called building and safety. It should be called building and revenue, because that seems to be the biggest thing that the concern is, making sure that we pay extra money for whatever it is that we want to do on our property. So I would like that there'd be some more information on this about what changes are actually being changed to the code or not to the code.
That is, because it did have some significant changes. And then there's a section in there talking about level severity 3 for water supply, and it says that in communities with a level of severity 3, whenever the use of inclusionary density bonus units allowed by the ordinance will cause a development to exceed otherwise generally allowed densities, the decision-making body shall find substantial evidence to support a conclusion that estimated non-agricultural water demand of the density bonus units, and that they will not exceed the estimated non-agricultural water demand of the project without the density bonus units. And that would seem to impinge on the ag cluster subdivision ordinance, since under certain circumstances it allows a density bonus. And so does this erode some provisions of that, and should it be separated out and brought in for a broader discussion? And then there's a section that talks about testing, and it's confusing. It would seem that maybe it pertains to grading, because above it are some references to all these sections or parts of Section 22. And then there's this paragraph that says, the director may also require the applicant to pay for testing to be performed by an independent laboratory, et cetera, et cetera. And I guess if it's about grading, that's okay, but it isn't clear from the document if it's just that or it may pertain to other things in there. And it wasn't real clear. So, we were just wondering if these things could be cleared up or if you needed to continue it.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Mr. Pelfrey.
Well, good afternoon. First off, Karen, I
if I didn't use your familiar name. Thank you for your service. It's the only job you'll have that you can learn to hate and love at the same time. And I saw you tear up, which is kind of ironic, because although we differ in ideologies, often I've been against you, but I admire anybody that would take the time to serve. No matter what the pay is, it's always going to be tough. I have a couple of problems with number 28. RMS went through planning. There was also letters, I believe, from Napomo, I know for a fact, from TAG, concerning it and asking for a hearing before the board. I told you on December 2nd that we needed to have this, and it was hidden in number 3 and 4. These two things here were number 3 and 4 on the December 2nd agenda, and in order to know about them even being on the agenda, you had to read the staff report. That's the RMS and the name change, because they weren't noted. I have also found out that your California Building Standards Code, the reason I couldn't find it is because it's listed under California Green Building Standards Code at the state level, and that the UBC was superseded by the ICC, which is the International Construction Code. So most of the state is using the ICC. To change it to the CBSC, there are differences between the two. I called a contact in Fresno who uses this. They would actually like to go back to the ICC because the cost incurred with it stops workforce housing from being built, stops low-income housing from being built. It adds fees because most of it is privately contracted out to do, like, your plan assessments, your site assessments, and you go to each one different one, so it's a private contractor. That gets added to the building fees. Now, I think you need a matrix between the ICC and this CBSC rather than put it flat out, because there is a difference, a substantial difference. And not using the name California Green Building Standard Code made it impossible to read up on it, and there's thousands and thousands of pages. I got that by calling down here this morning, and one of the staff said, look under this, and there it was. And it's about 6,000 pages long, and I'm sorry, I can't do it in that short a time. It's just impossible. So I would ask that you pull those two so that the people, by their right, can be informed. Now, the RMS, it's not the communities that have come at fault. It's
the second page, page 2 of 3, at the top, Title 19 of the county code, that used to read UBC. So it's actually another UBC reference, but since it was the language was slightly different, it was separated out from the other ones. So there's that one. And I'll switch it over to Mike for the other question.
Thanks, Brian. Thank you, Brian. Mike Wolkin, planning staff. Just wanted to address a couple of things, and maybe Cammie would like to also address one of the comments. Just wanted to make clear that we're not changing any codes today. We're simply changing references to the appropriate code. So the changes in codes were made a while back when the board adopted the uniform building standards code. So just references today is all we're doing in the various documents. There were a couple comments about the RMS. Your board held a hearing on December 2nd. That was a noticed hearing, and tentatively adopted a number of changes to the resource management system, which is in framework for planning both inland and coastal. And so today is the scheduled final action on that. That's what's before you today is final action on the RMS and as well as the Cambria zoning change and the cleanup amendments.
Okay.
Really, that's all I wanted to add. I don't know if Cammie wanted to address one of the other comments.
I did want to point out, as Mike did, your board held public hearings both this year and last year to update Title 19
and adopt those new building standards that the state mandates that counties apply. So even if we didn't adopt them, they would apply. But we do adopt our own local versions. There is a Cal Green Code, but there is also a local county Green Code, too. So the amendments today are just simply the titles, correcting the titles of those documents in our other ordinances. It wouldn't matter if we didn't correct the titles. We still would use the required elements that the state mandates that we do. There was a question that Mr. Brown raised about the applicability of a section relative to the level of severity 3. I did want to point out that that change was in the affordable housing density bonus section, not any other section, and it's a clarification that is required based on a court settlement. So it was just for the affordable housing.
Very good. Thank you. And Supervisor Arnold, did you have a further question about Attachment 1E?
I did.
And my apologies. I didn't realize that was actually on the cleanup amendments. So
it's all right. This has been kind of jumping around anyway.
We're on page 1180 of 1184 of our consolidated.
And I'll just say it out and just ask the question, and then I don't even know if we. Anyway, for reference, I'm on page 1 of 3 of the attachment 1E, and I'm down on number. It's section 3, number 2, where it's bold. Level of severity 3 for water supply. It's bold. So my question then is, this is really confusing to me, too. In communities with a certified level of severity 3 for water supply, whenever the use of inclusionary density bonus units allowed by this ordinance. So my first question was, inclusionary density bonus units, is that inclusionary based on income qualifications, or what inclusionary are we talking about?
I'm going to defer to county council.
I can speak to this. I'm Tim McNulty with the county council's office. So this language is, if the board approves it, will resolve litigation that was brought by the Napomo Community Services District a few years back when the board adopted its affordable housing ordinance. I don't know if you remember this or not, but mostly we had here at our meetings Director Wynn, who was concerned that by adopting an inclusionary housing ordinance, which allows for the addition of more units if you're going to build affordable units and you're going to guarantee that they remain affordable for a certain period of time, that would have an effect in Napomo that would be deleterious because of the water situation that then and now exists in Napomo. And so they, although we approved that amendment with an environmental impact report, NCSD sued us over that EIR, and as a means of resolving that language, we agreed that in the event that those kind of density bonus units were going to be approved in areas of LOS 3, that we would have this finding inserted, and the finding is there in the paragraph that you've identified, and that is, so whenever someone comes in and they want to use,
and you're going to use less water than you would if you didn't add the house. The house would have to use no water.
You have to use the same amount of water as if you didn't add the house. So yeah, clearly the NCSD believes that they think they've found a way to prevent inclusionary housing units from being built there under the county's ordinance. I don't know if that's true or not, but.
But it doesn't say anything about you can offset, you can, sure. It just says you will use less than the project with or without the extra house or two houses or whatever.
Yeah, I don't want to mischaracterize what it says because it says exactly what's here in the ordinance. But the decision makers will need to make a finding that the estimated non-agricultural water demand of the density bonus units, so let's say there's two of those, is not going to exceed the estimated non-ag water demand of the project without those two units.
Well, so, then what I'll use Supervisor Ray's terminology in layman's terms here, we're saying that we're going to make it really hard and to include, have the affordable inclusionary housing on those projects.
Again, local inclusionary housing. So we're not attempting to impose any limit on our obligation to comply with the state's inclusionary housing requirements.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
No.
Okay. Mr. Meacham?
And that's just strictly applicable to level of severity 3, is that correct?
Okay.
Yes.
I'm going to shift into another area of process, kind of to respond to Mr. Graywell's point. I was an electrical contractor. One of the worst things I had to experience was changing the rules in the middle of the game. But I do believe, and I want to ask how our staff deals with code changes from the building industry that come down from the state. We have to basically adopt whatever they mm-hmm. send down. But if someone submits their plan and has a permit to build whatever it is they're going to build, that building permit is based upon whatever the current adopted codes are. Is that not correct?
Yes, and in fact, every time that the state makes a change like this, we get this little bump in building permits for people trying to beat the code in so that they're under the previous code. And it's usually just because of a familiarity with that code, but sometimes it is because there are significant changes. And so we saw two of those little bumps actually this past couple of years based on the changes to the state codes coming through and people beating those state codes in.
But they still, their building is still based upon whatever the
current whatever the code was
when
in effect.
It was adopted in effect.
That's right.
Now, I know it's much more difficult for a general contractor that does everything. I was just strictly electrical. But how do we make public the changes that are going to be applicable to the next round? Is it this is the way we do this right now?
No, actually, our building division spends a lot of time going out to the public. They go out to their industry groups. We do try and get the word out when things are changing. Usually it's not a surprise. If you're in the business, you usually know that those changes are coming up. It is more difficult for the owner-builder who doesn't typically track those, but most of the contractors are aware of changes coming up, and we do make a real effort to go out and reach those folks.
I know that we used to have a builder's exchange. I don't think we have that anymore, but I know the builder's exchange used to be able to provide us with a list of the changes that were coming, and so you'd get your permits in plenty of time. I just wanted to clarify the process, and I thank you for that. Ms. Ray.
I'm sure this is for Tim. So I was processing. I hadn't thought this through real carefully about the impact on, you know, potential inclusionary housing. So is one way that there would be flexibility in this rather than the elimination of density bonuses in LOS 3 areas would be, for example, let's pretend that you were going to build 10 four-bedroom homes, and you wanted to get a density bonus that would allow you to build 12 homes, then you would essentially do something like eliminate bedrooms that would eliminate water usage that would be offset by the new units, and that's how you could achieve that flexibility?
Yeah, I think there is room to move here. You would have to demonstrate, let me just say the decision makers would have to find, so there would have to be substantial evidence in the record to support a finding that the water demand of the density bonus units, and the way this is worded, that the water demand of the density bonus units will not exceed the water demand of the project without those units.
And that would be inclusive of indoor and outdoor usage, correct?
That's right.
Okay, that helps.
So maybe you do pave over what was going to be your
right.
playground or something like that. I don't know.
Mr. McNulty.
So, but it's not a complete shutdown is what I'm trying to point out.
No, and it's also, this is a very narrow application of this. It really only applies to what the county adopted by way of inclusionary housing requirements back, you know, I think this all happened, honestly, about 3 or 4 years ago. It's taken that long to resolve it.
All right, thank you.
Very good. With no other
ordinances, because that's built into the resolution.
I was going to. Darn it.
That's what I can do for you,
you know,
on my
like,
last day.
Well, I wanted to hear. You actually did it for the clerk. Yeah, I wanted to hear her read one time. But.
And, Mr. Chair, that did. Yeah. Those are the resolutions and ordinances ordinance in the staff report, and there's not any changes to those,
no.
as I
correct.
Understand it correctly.
That's my understanding. All right. With all that, clear as can be, thank you, Ms. Griffin, Mr. McNulty, and Madam Clerk. A roll call vote, please.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Thank you. That has concluded our business for today. We are now adjourning to closed session tomorrow, which we will start here in these chambers at 9 o'clock. As we depart, let me wish you all the very best of the holiday season and a happy new year and a happy retirement and a happy future. So we will get at it again tomorrow, and we are done for the day.
Just happy, happy, happy.
It is. It's darn happy.